Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
And the Museum of Science, where their new exhibit, Changing Landscapes, An Immersive Journey, transports you to iconic spots around the globe to see how people are adapting to a changing climate. More at mos.org.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio. We're one day into this latest Congress, still with no speaker, but Ayanna Pressley is present, heading into her third term in the House. She'll zoom in from Washington to talk about chaos in the House, community projects she's getting funded here at home, and where she stands on the uncertainty over Biden's student loan debt relief in 2023.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Things are notably more chaotic for Pressley's colleagues across the aisle. Three votes, three humiliating failed bids by Kevin McCarthy to run the House of Representatives. It's the first time in a century this has happened. We'll open the phone and text lines to ask, are you basking in GOP schadenfreude or preparing yourself for what's to come when they finally do manage to zero in on their priorities, going after Dr. Fauci, Hunter Biden, and the FBI? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. All that to come, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
We're going to be joined in a second by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who I'm assuming got to sit through the debacle of yesterday's attempt to pick a speaker. We're going to talk to you about the implications of that mess that's going to continue today at noon after we speak to the Congresswoman. So, again, she'll start in a couple of seconds. First time in 100 years, everybody knows this.
First time in 100 years, yep. That
a speaker candidate was not elected on the first ballot, 1923. Three ballots, and actually the number of people who voted for someone other than him went up from 19 to 20, I think on the third ballot. So, I mean, it's only one additional vote, but actually he's losing votes. And so even though he's saying, I'm going to stay in this thing forever, kind of. In fact, we should play that. Here is Kevin McCarthy.
I thought you were going to play the entrance.
No.
We're going to do Santos.
We're going to hold Congressman Santos another day in the life of George Santos for a little while. Here's a little bit of Kevin McCarthy, who obviously had a very bad day. Three separate votes. Congress adjourned for the day. No speaker. Says he plans to keep running. Here he is answering one of the millions of questions from reporters yesterday.
Is there any reason for where you're backing out?
No.
Is there any reason for us?
You guys ask me that same question a lot, so I'll let you know when that happens, okay? But it's not going to happen.
Did I hear last night on CNN, and I was half asleep, that he has already moved into the speaker's office?
And he had to move
physically?
Out? He's already moved into the speaker's office, yes, and there was some concern about whether he would have to move out last night.
Well, who gives him the authority? Can I move into the speaker's office?
He just kind of he counted his eggs in basket before he should have.
Whatever that expression is. Can I repeat something I said yesterday that I was not aware of until recently? You don't need to be a member of the House to be the Speaker of the House. And the one person who I assume could get 218 votes is Donald Trump. Don't you think? I mean, it's a lot of work, and he's not exactly someone who's a workhorse kind of thing. But can you see Donald Trump as Speaker of the House and indicted Speaker of the House probably in a few months,
well,
too?
Well, I think for those voters who are concerned about the antics of Donald Trump in the midterm elections, that could be a very bad thing for the GOP. Let's put it that way.
Okay, you're listening to Boston Public Radio. Ayanna Pressley, Congresswoman from the 7th CD, is going to be joining us in a couple of seconds.
You know, it was,
and as I say, I'm assuming she sat through, well, she had to sit through the whole thing because she had a vote for Hakeem Jeffries. And by the way, do you notice on almost every, I think on every ballot he got more votes than Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
How great was that, by the way? I mean, one of the beauties of this thing.
Didn't it start at 5 or 6, and then all of a sudden it was at 19 and 20?
Is the left and the far right is reveling in the same spectacle yesterday.
Right. It's a spectacle.
Congresswoman Pressley, she's with us. Joining us now is Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. As you know, she represents the 7th Congressional District, and she's one of the New York Times' most stylish people of 2022. Congratulations on that, and welcome, Congresswoman.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too,
Congresswoman. What are you laughing about? Tell me you didn't love that.
Because you said style.
Did you love that? Tell the truth.
Let me tell you what I loved. I loved that the reason I was being named one of the most stylish is because of the space that I occupy as a woman living with alopecia. Yep. And I know what that means to my alopecia community in the country and around the globe. So, you know, if you want to join the Baldy Club, you know, you might make the list too, you know.
I'm pretty close to the club, my friend. So,
you know, on one serious note before we get into what went on yesterday up there, Congresswoman, I don't think a lot of people even knew what alopecia was.
I didn't.
Before you began to talk about it. I think it was something that people endured quietly and we didn't know about it in the wider population. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. A lot of people just suffering in silence, you know. So, again, I'm just proud to be representative of that community and to take up that space. And it means the world when my baldy babies, you know, the kids that are living with this autoimmune disease, you know, tell me that I remind them that they can do anything.
That's great. That's really great.
Well, Congressman, let's get back to what went on yesterday up in down in Washington, I should say. I mean, you know, you I assume were there with the people with their babies and their families, everybody dressed up for a celebratory day, coming to see their loved ones sworn in to take their duties in Congress. And what was it like when this just kind of didn't happen?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's a bit like Groundhog's Day. I mean, it's unprecedented in some ways, the historical precedents, but it's also consistent with how the Republicans have moved. They are chaotic. They are not centering that which is most important in this moment, and that is the people. They've proven that they are ill-equipped to govern, dysfunctional, and Kevin McCarthy is certainly unfit to be speaker. And as is so often said by this generation, the math is not mathing.
You know, Congresswoman, to be clear, I didn't even think about this till last night, but please correct me if I'm wrong. While most of us are focused, as we will be again at noon, on will there be a person who gets 218 votes who is the next speaker to succeed Nancy Pelosi, until there is a speaker, everything is in paralysis, right? I don't think you were sworn in. Correct me if I'm wrong. They're not committees. There's even if the Republicans did know how to lead a functioning House, it can't function because there's no infrastructure till there's a speaker. Am I right about that?
That's correct. We did have a Congressional Black Caucus ceremonial swearing in, and certainly there was much pomp and circumstance and celebration of our being on the precipice of making history in electing the first African-American minority leader. But we have not officially been sworn in. We have not voted on a rules package. And again, as joyful as I am about our having a Democratic leadership team in Hakeem Jeffries and Catherine Clark and Pete Aguilar, that is a representative of the diversity of this great country and what that will mean, what we saw happening across the aisle and the ways in which that has Congress and the American people in limbo is shameful. It's a disgrace. The world is watching, and this is simply dysfunctional. And so for every hour that we are delayed here, the Republicans are hurting the American people at a time of great consequence and an inflection point for our nation.
You know, there is one bright side. I mean, you have the honor, I think, for the first time of serving with a guy who won a Nobel Peace Prize, two Pulitzers, an NBA championship. That, of course, is George Santos. Did you get to meet Congressman, soon to be Congressman Santos yesterday?
He might be the only one that was having a worse day than Kevin McCarthy. But no, I did not meet Mr. Santos.
Okay, one last question, a serious question about yesterday. It, all the scenarios that are being played out, assuming McCarthy can't get to 218, some are speculating that Democrats join with moderate Republicans, and there are some, to get to 218, and somebody like Fred Upton, a non-lunatic Republican, becomes Speaker of the House. Is that preposterous, or is that within at least the distant realm of possibility?
Oh, Jim, how I enjoy you and your West Wing conspiracies. Someone is even doing some binge watching, perhaps.
Maybe.
You know, I don't want to. I think, in all seriousness, look, what we're squarely focused on in this moment is that the contrast could not be clearer. And how they have started this 118th Congress, the Republicans, again, just makes that contrast that much starker. Democrats now have 2 years to continue to center the people and to make the clear and affirmative case for the Democrats. And I'm confident that if we continue to do that, that in 2 years, we will take that gavel back. Mm. We will have the majority and begin to effectively lay, well, right now begins the work of laying the groundwork for 2024. I think what we continue to see with the Republicans is, you know, they play with people's lives, you know, as they are in this moment, playing with Congress and our government and leaving the American people in limbo, while Democrats are changing and saving lives and focused on standing in the gap to mitigate the hurt, to alleviate hardship. In the past 2 years, you know, delivering on life-changing policies like student debt cancellation and lowering insulin costs for families and climate justice and investing in local community projects. And so I think the chaos of yesterday only makes that contrast that much clearer. And I think the choice in 2 years that much clearer.
We're talking with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. You know, Congresswoman, when people talk about why diversity is so important in all aspects of life, the obvious first thing is that people come to their experiences with different perspectives. If they're a woman, if they're a man, if they're gay, if they're black or whatever. I mean, we've had kind of a estrogen surge here in Massachusetts with Maura Healey, Andrea Campbell, we've got Kim Driscoll, former mayor of Salem, lieutenant governor, right down the line, Diana
DeZoglio.
DeZoglio. Thank you. I struggle to pronounce that word in Massachusetts here. It's really something.
It certainly is. And, you know, that didn't just happen. I mean, that is, you know, the impact and an outcome in leadership parity at every level of government that has been decades in the making. And so I'm very proud to be serving in this Massachusetts congressional delegation. We're the only delegation in the country that's still all Democratic. It's also a formidable and very powerful delegation, and including now that Catherine Clock will be serving as the whip, and then to be living in and serving in a commonwealth that will have a historic governor and lieutenant governor and attorney general, and the list goes on. So provided that I'm sworn in as a member of Congress, I look forward to physically being at the Garden and the State House, respectively, to bear witness to this historic moment. And I do want to just say how much I'm looking forward to working with the Healey Driscoll administration, and am just thankful for in all the ways that Mara has been standing in the gap in the issues that she and I have worked on throughout the years. And so we're on the precipice of a very exciting shift. I'll be leaning on my city halls and the state house and the corner office, especially in the next 2 years with the Republicans in the majority. It's really important that we are exacting every lever available to us. You know, I'm still going to continue to push on executive action from the Biden-Harris administration. Dems do still have the White House. I've done, you know, good work with them on repealing Title 42, been in close partnership on canceling student debt, of which I was a lead negotiator, pushing for a federal moratorium on the death penalty. And we'll continue to push for an executive agenda there. I'm very encouraged in my role as chair of the Abortion Rights and Access Task Force that the Biden-Harris administration has heeded our calls around medication abortion. So I'll continue to push on those fronts, but also, you know, leaning on Governor Healey and the Healey Driscoll administration for their partnership on so many issues of consequence.
You know, speaking of abortion, the FDA has made some moves that will make it easier for women around the country to get abortion pills. They're going to be available in more U.S. pharmacies. In Massachusetts, where abortion remains legal, I don't think it's that big of a deal, or maybe it is. But explain what this FDA ruling means.
No, absolutely. And I know I was mentioning the partnership of the White House on that front to preserve and expand medication abortion. This is an issue that I've been working on for a couple of years, even before the Dobbs decision and my role on the Oversight Committee. And so I'm really grateful to the Biden-Harris administration for working with us and taking this necessary action. Abortion care is a human right, and we have to use every tool available to affirm it as such. And this is really just going to help folks be able to access the abortion care that they need and deserve. You know, and so I'm glad that the FDA, because we did do follow-up advocacy on this front, that they have heeded our call to expand access to medication abortion. It's a drug called mifepristone.
It's glad you're pronouncing it rather than me. You know, Congresswoman Presley, you mentioned student debt cancellation, and I think people who are paying attention know that you and Elizabeth Warren were leaders on this effort. Joe Biden did, depending on your circumstance, 10 or 20,000. We all know you were urging him to do 50, but he did act by executive action. We all know the courts got involved. Celebration, I assume, from those who are going to benefit has turned to grave anxiety about what is actually going to happen. What is going to happen? And what do you tell people who are drowning in this debt, who, you know, felt they were about to get some relief and all of a sudden it was taken away from them, or at least temporarily?
Look, this is, in many ways, it is more of the same from the Republicans, who I think move in a way of contempt and callousness for the American people and complete disconnectedness from the hardships they experience. And it is their backlash to popular Democratic policies. Biden campaigned in the midterms on the CHIPS legislation and bipartisan infrastructure and the need to preserve reproductive access and bodily autonomy, but also on student debt cancellation. So these policies are wildly popular and deeply meaningful and impactful. And so it's no response. It's no surprise that they continue to move with politics instead of centering the people. And so this relief is on hold because Republicans are doing everything that they can to stop people from getting this relief, even their very own constituents. And we know that this is impacting people from every walk of life. So the administration's legal case is sound. The president has the authority of that, we know. The only question is, will this far right Supreme Court follow the law or continue their streak of obstructing the will of the people and turning a blind eye to the hardship they're experiencing? You know, people are always surprised when I tell them that I literally have 76-year-olds in my district living on fixed incomes who have had their benefits garnished because they're still paying on student loans.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is an intergenerational economic justice, racial justice issue impacting people from every walk of life, tradesmen and women, millennials, Gen Z, our elders, Black parents disproportionately who took out Parent PLUS loans, who can't even retire because they're still paying on these loans for their kids, in a country where we've said that education is life's great equalizer and the cost has increased by 150%. So, and we continue to put that great equalizer out of reach for the majority of Americans. And so, you know, we were exhaustive in using every tool possible to get this done. And it really is just more of the same from Republicans. So,
Congresswoman,
we can't stop pushing. I mean, it's just what choice do we have? We have to stand in the gap.
Congresswoman, you managed to get a great piece of legislation passed into law, this Post-Disaster Mental Health Response Act. Tell people about it.
And about this woman, Monya Chelinsky,
yes,
who neither of
Boston
us ever heard
Marathon.
Of before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I am, you know, I say it all the time, policy is my love language. So I'm deeply proud to have passed this critical bill and sent it to President Biden's desk, where it was signed into law.
Yeah.
And I worked with, you know, I say the people close to the pain should be close to the power, driving and informing the policy making. And that's what we did here. Survivors of natural disasters or terrorist attacks like this Boston Marathon bombing, they're often, you know, left grappling with lasting trauma and the devastating impacts of their own mental health. There's primary trauma, secondary trauma, and that's an issue that I've been leading on for a very long time. And so Manya Chilinski, I developed this bill in partnership with her. She's a survivor of the marathon bombing. And she had reached out to our office, I think in an email. I can't even tell you exactly what year that was, but we followed up. And so we passed the Post-Disaster Mental Health Act after 2 years of, you know, writing the bill and advocacy to get it across the finish line. And what this is a technical fix that would then allow FEMA to be able to get help to survivors of all disasters. So that includes domestic terrorism and natural disasters. So it's just what it will do is, for example, the marathon attack received an emergency declaration from FEMA, and that gave Boston access to some federal relief. But because it wasn't given a major disaster declaration, robust federal support for mental health issues wasn't even on the table. And yeah. It wasn't an option. And so this is a technical fix that will save lives. That is what my Post-Disaster Mental Health Act, which was just signed into law, that's what that will do.
By the way, is that connected? I hope I'm not confusing things. Didn't you bring a ton of money back for smaller agencies back home that are dealing with trauma-related things? Am I confusing two things?
No.
Is that part of the same deal?
No, you're not confusing anything. What you are is paying attention. And for that, I'm grateful, Jim.
Thank you kindly.
So, yes, this is our second round of community project funding, formerly called Earmarks. And I was, you know, able in this last round to secure some $14 million for 12 projects. And one of those robust investments is to support those doing community-based trauma-informed work.
You know, I'm going to end with exactly the same question I ask you almost every time you're on. One of the reasons we like to have you on, beyond the fact you are the Congresswoman, is because your positivity almost balances our pessimism about everything, Congresswoman. But you're assuming you get sworn in at some point in the next few months. Essentially, other than
the next few months.
Well, I mean, that to me, it looks like
I was just thinking about, you know, I am going to the floor with my backpack of, I'm prepared today. I wasn't prepared yesterday.
Yeah.
Today I'm going and prepared, but we're not allowed to eat on the floor. But I've got my jerky and my Kind bars and my squeezable applesauce. So I'll be sneaking that in. But hopefully this is going to happen.
Yeah, might need sleeping bags.
But how do you, I think it was in Vanity Fair. It was a great piece about you, actually, that you're running to be chair or president or something of the Democratic Women's Caucus. And I know you're pushing Biden for executive action where it is legally permissible. But talk in the last minute about mindset when you're about to go into your third term, knowing that the best, I assume, that's going to happen in the House is stopping a backwards movement on its way to the Senate. What's the mindset with which you approach this third term when it starts, Congresswoman?
Conviction, resolve, cooperative governing, optimism, and remaining joyful in pursuit of all of those things.
Oh my God!
And it's not hard, Jim. It's not only just core to my DNA and to who I am, but I'm battle tested, brother. Have you been paying attention, my brother and sister here, to the context under which I've been governing the last almost 4 years here in Washington?
Yeah.
I mean, I came in a government shutdown. We've twice impeached the former occupant of the White House. We've survived an insurrection, are still, you know, in the midst of a global pandemic and recovery from that economically and otherwise. And the recovery, and the impacts, rather, of it, and a pandemic-induced recession. So I'm battle-tested. I'm not new to governing. And, you know, my approach won't change. It doesn't matter who's in power. I'm going to work cooperatively with those most impacted and continue to advance bold policies and budgetary investments that save and improve lives. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Massachusetts Democrat. And while the Republicans are over here playing with people's lives, I'm with the party that's about changing and saving lives. And that's the work that I wake up every day excited to take on.
It's a long way from dealing with exploding manhole covers, isn't it, Congresswoman?
Oh, the dogs that were electrocuted.
Either way,
that was terrible.
Honor.
What's that?
It's an honor either way.
Yeah. I hope they
I know you mean it.
I just hope they don't investigate Dr. Fauci, Congresswoman.
He can handle it,
come
let me
on.
Tell you. He can handle it. Ayanna Pressley, congratulations on the third term when it begins. We really appreciate your time as always.
Thank you so much.
Thank
well.
You
Happy
very
New
much.
Year.
Happy New
you
Year
too,
to
of
you.
Course.
And congratulations on the mental health legislation. That's
a
big deal.
I don't know about this.
Yeah, it is a big deal.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley represents the Massachusetts 7th District, and we're very grateful for her time. Okay, coming up. It's day two of Republican Kevin McCarthy's very
Listen,
embarrassing
Marjorie,
bid
you are really a
to
loser.
Be House Speaker after three humiliating failed ballots yesterday. He is back for more.
He is.
Are you reveling in his failure and the loneliness of would-be Congressman George Santos, who we don't know what his name is from day to day, and we don't know what he did yesterday or where he lives or what he's all
Nor
about.
Does he.
But he's trying to become a congressman. We'll see how far he gets. The next number to call, if you want to talk about this, is 877-301-8970. You can call us or text us at that number with your reaction to everything going on down in D.C. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marj Regan. When George Santos got to Congress yesterday, he was met not by excitement from his fellow new class of representatives, who mostly ignored him if you were watching TV, but instead he was hit with a barrage of questions from reporters.
Are you worried about the charges in the jail?
Do you feel like you're qualified to serve in this Congress right now?
Are you copying your position, sir? Sir, are you copying your position? Sir.
Any comments? Outside of your office.
Are you pretending to look at your phone?
Are you pretending to look at your phone? We have more sound from reporters doing their jobs. Yes, it was Santos. We'll play in a minute. He has vowed, that would be George Santos, has vowed support to Kevin McCarthy in his so far failed bid for House Speaker. McCarthy famously pledged fealty to Donald Trump in the days after the January 6th insurrection. In turn, both of these men, I think it's fair to say, have been publicly shamed. And we want to know, as Marjorie said a minute ago, are you reveling in their discomfort? Give us a call or text us at 877-301-8970. Or are you viewing the drama as a harbinger of horrible things to come if the House members can ever get sworn in, that is? 877-301-8970. You know, even if he did get to 218 votes, I assume most people listening know that one of the compromises or deals he had to strike with the far right people who weren't supporting him was they could a motion to, quote, vacate the chair, meaning dump the speaker, only requires five votes. Well, if there are 19 people, now 20, who didn't vote for him on the third ballot, obviously anytime they don't,
the speaker every
they don't
week.
Like anything he does.
Yeah.
Exactly. And by the way, if people say, well, that amuses me, Republican chaos, etc., things like debt. Things like all the basics you have to do of government. How does a speaker, Kevin McCarthy, keep his people in line? They keep his people in line only by doing things that are antithetical to the best interests of the United States of America.
I mean,
exactly.
They think it's a great idea to shut down the government. Remember last time we shut down the government, the Trump administration, with these federal workers that were broke within 2 weeks because they were
paid
so...
Remember Jose Andres feeding them in Washington,
too? They were making so little money that they had no savings to sustain them when the government shut down for more than 2 weeks. You know, he's getting what he deserves. Kevin McCarthy.
Oh.
I mean, he, as many people have pointed out, he seems to have no principles whatsoever. And when you're touting the future career of Marjorie Taylor Greene, that I think most people with a quarter of a common sense think is lost her marbles or never had any marbles to begin with. And he's touting her and going to put her, give her more power in the United States Congress. I mean, come on.
You know what's beautiful about this, too? And we'll get to your calls and texts in a second. 877-301-8970 is every, we've discussed this a million times, but it bears repeating. The guy who wants to be speaker on January 6th spoke the truth about Donald Trump's culpability for the insurrection attempt. And then he decided I can't be Speaker of the House if I'm a person of principle. So he runs the, I was wrong, by the way. It wasn't a thumbs up photo. I saw it for last night. A week later, he's down or whatever it was in Mar-a-Lago, you know, paying fealty to the to Trump. And then what does Trump do yesterday? The 19 and 20 people, at least 19 of the 20 who voted for someone other than McCarthy, kept him from becoming Speaker, are all Trump sycophants. They're all MAGA people.
Right.
Meaning, and Trump theoretically is supporting the sycophantic McCarthy.
That's right.
All Trump had to do was call his 19 little boys and girls and say, you got to vote for Kevin McCarthy. Trust me, he's going to do the right thing. Obviously, he didn't do it because he's got a lot of sway with these people. So Trump was a leader of the insurrection. No, he wasn't, because I need his help, says McCarthy. And then it's payback time. Trump is screwing McCarthy by sitting this one out. I mean, there's no loyalty amongst corrupt politicians.
Well, I think that you've seen this throughout the Trump administration, that people who have stood up for him have not.
Exactly right.
The president, foreign president, not reciprocated by standing up for them when they're in their times of trials. Maybe Roger Stone was an exception. He got him out of the hot seat.
Now, here's the deal I made with Marjorie, and usually I don't say on the air deals we made behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
She said we could only discuss the speaker's race if we played clips from George Santos 11 times in 30 minutes. So here is a reporter who deserves a Pulitzer for
Absolutely.
These four questions. Here, we don't know who he is, and our apologies. As soon as we find out, we'll let you know. Here is a reporter confronting Mr. Santos before he walked into the Capitol.
What's your name today? Is it Anthony DeVolder or is it George Santos? Do you think anyone in New York actually trusts you? Do you have any idea what you're doing today? Are you pretending to look at your phone?
Are you pretending to look at your phone? We almost cut off the first one. The first one is your name today, Anthony DeVolder or George Santos. And by the way, what he's doing through the whole, all the clips is he's looking at his phone.
Right.
Obviously, he's not looking at anything.
Yeah.
And then the beauty, and then we'll get to your calls, I promise. The beauty is when he finally gets into the Capitol, he's walking to his office to avoid the reporters. His young aide bellies up to him and whispers in his ear, "We're going the wrong way."
That's right. They have to,
and
do
they
a
have to turn around. They were going the wrong
way. You know, I don't mean to be holier than thou, but I do think when you have a person like this, like Mr. Santos. Clearly has some serious problems of
does.
His own.
I think he
that,
does.
That Kevin McCarthy, who wants to be Speaker of the House, has to put up with him because Santos
said
he's going to vote for him. So it just is kind of like, how low can you get? You know what I mean? So the chickens may be coming home.
I think on your first day in Congress, if someone says, do you know what you're doing? I think that's a bad omen.
Do you know what your name is today? Is it Jim Browdy or is it Bruce Smith? I mean, you know what I mean? It's a basic question. Either you have a name or you don't have a name.
So we want to get your reaction to obviously the Santos thing, but much more importantly, how you're reacting to the speaker thing. By the way, the voting is going to continue, the fourth ballot at noon today. We will bring you the results as soon as we get them. Bill in Cambridge, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for your call. Hi.
Hi. Love you guys.
Thanks.
You cover so many great speakers.
You.
And you're fun and funny. First time call, though, but love you guys.
Thank you kindly. Lovely. Very
thank
nice.
You.
My comment. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, guys. My comment. In addition to all the great points you guys made, the MAYAC, it's terrible to not have a legislative body in Congress. It's they don't know how to govern. But one minor silver lining, I think it does expose how little care for the majority rule that the right-wing MAGA types have, the 2019. It's really going to piss off their colleagues and independents and centrists.
Totally right.
Say, look at these clowns. They're 20 people and they think they can obstruct the other 190. This may clarifies it. Sometimes it's the bad gets more clarified. Unfortunately, it seems to happen so much with Trump. But this could be one of those moments for people to be in revulsion and say goodbye this Republican Party for putting up with them.
Well, that's thanks for a great first call, Bill. And that's exactly what Ayanna Pressley, I think, was saying at the beginning of the conversation with us a few minutes ago, is that when this kind of thing happens, which is totally contrary to what the American people were saying in their votes for the House, obviously that's why the Republicans picked up such a small majority. It's not only disrespectful to voters, but they may end up paying a price if this is just the beginning of 2 years of this come 2024. 877-301-8970.
Okay, Schadenfreude. Okay. Mike from Nashua says he can't spell it. I can't say it.
Well, I can't
but
say
he
it either,
said
actually.
he can't spell it, but he says he loves the feeling of McCarthy and Santos. They lack any degree of pride or shame, which is often true. I always think, what does McCarthy's wife think of him? What does his family think of him? His siblings think of him? The way he's just totally debased himself. And that's what a lot of people are talking about. Chris in Westminster says, I don't get these obstructionists. He led, this is Trump, he led the Kiss Trump's Backside. Last I checked, those against him are also Trump psychopaths.
They're big Trump. They're big. That's what I said. They're big. Yeah. Well, I don't know if they're psychopaths. They are Trump sycophants, virtually all of them. I mean, even though he made a speech nominating McCarthy, the person who got the most votes yesterday is the ultimate Trump sycophant, the jacketless Jim Jordan from Ohio, who, by the way, escaped the law by about an inch when it came to some problems in locker rooms. But was it Ohio State back
home? Yes, it was wrestling, and it was abusive, sexual abuse of team members.
But again, he was, for the record, he was not charged with anything.
No.
He was looked at, but nothing happened.
I think it was a blind eye kind of situation.
That's my take. Jim in Manchester, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hey, I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
And I'll be brief.
Sure.
I'm not reveling in Congressman McCarthy's problems. I'm alarmed for the country. We have a Congress now that is in the majority. Most of them are election deniers.
Correct.
How do we expect to get anything done with people who are so freaking stupid to still carry on and believe that? That is frightening, and we should all be very alarmed. Thank you. I'm going to shut up now.
You know, Jim, I don't want you to shut up now because I want to compliment you. Margaret Sullivan, who Marjorie and I both admire,
she used
to be the ombudsperson or the media thing or something for the Washington Post and the New York Times. She said that when reporters, anchors, news people cover this next Congress, it is critical to say all the time, as you just did and we didn't, that the majority of members of the House of Representatives on the Republican side were people who voted to overturn the election results. Years ago, November. That is huge, and I'm really glad you made up for our failure. And thank you for your call. Call again soon. We really appreciate it. Roughly 140. I don't know the precise number. Roughly 140 of the 222, is it, I think, Republicans in the House voted not to certify the election results, even though, who were we talking to yesterday? I can't remember who it was. Oh, Gina McCarthy, about climate change,
right.
Whether Republicans, former head of the EPA, climate advisor to Joe Biden, EPA for Obama, if the Republicans really believe this anti-climate problem crap. And she said, no. Do you think the vast majority, I mean, Lauren Boebert, with all due respect, is dumb as a post. She may think Donald Trump really won the election. Do you think the vast majority of the 140, think that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president of the United States? Yet they voted not to certify
damn
election.
I guess that's the thing. We always talk about politicians lie and politicians exaggerate and they're out to get reelected and all this kind of stuff. But this is all beyond the pale. You know, I mean, people used to be very upset about things. Like if you posed, in the climate of gun tragedies we have all around this country, like it was great posing with your long guns, posing, taking aim at your constituents. People would, you think, what's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. But somehow we've kind of lost our decency or our outrage or something. And it didn't start with Donald Trump. I mean, it started before Trump, but it certainly accelerated, I think.
I have a George Santos update for you.
Oh,
a friend of ours just texted us an article from the Washington Examiner, in which Santos posts a press release saying he was sworn in as a member of the House by the Speaker of the House. The only problem is there's no Speaker and he wasn't sworn in.
Do you have any idea what you're doing today?
Exactly. Thank you very
much.
Well,
you know, I mean, places like the Wall Street Journal, that are Republican newspapers, conservative newspapers, they're getting a little nervous about this. Apparently Fox News.
Wait, about Santos? I didn't read the
About the whole situation.
Oh.
The whole dysfunction. And the idea that, you know, what the midterms told us, I think, you know, Hunter Biden may have done a lot of bad things, but I don't think it's the top of people's concern that we go after.
Which doesn't mean they can't do it or shouldn't do it, but not as I agree.
Or Dr. Fauci. And do we really think we should get rid of the FBI?
I'm not with you. I want them. Fauci is tough and smart. I want him in front of those Republicans, and I want him to deal with them as he does with Rand Paul.
Well, he made a fool of Rand Paul.
Oh, it's great. Karen in North Andover. Hi.
Well, good morning. Happy New Year. I have 2 points.
Please.
First of all, how many new laws does America have to create to fix all of these mistakes? I can't even imagine. And the other is, what if we have a complete sabotage of both KEV and MTG by our former president, who turns around and says, hey, make me speaker. I'll take care of it.
Well, I said at the top of the show, Karen, for those who don't think that's possible, I learned just recently you don't have to be a member of the House to be the Speaker of the House. And
yep,
they
don't
could
have to be at all.
They could elect, if they can get 218 votes for Trump, Donald Trump could be the next Speaker of the House of Representatives. Karen, thanks for the call.
By the time the Speaker of the House is elected, Santos might be found ineligible for office or be indicted or deported before being sworn in. That's from Mike in Acton. Okay, we're talking about the fiasco down in Congress. It's about to begin again in about 15 minutes. Luckily, we'll be able to watch it while we're the air here and see what happens with Kevin McCarthy today. But we're asking you about Kevin McCarthy, about George Santos. Do you have any hope for this Republican Congress, for the Congress in general? Our number is 877-301-8970. You can call us or text us at 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browder. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the chaotic start to Congress. Talk about euphemisms, which we will monitor again today starting at noon, so you don't have to go watch it. We'll tell you about it. GOP in disarray in the House. Kevin McCarthy's historically turbulent bid to be House Speaker. 877-301-8970.
Okay. Now, we have a press release here.
I just told you about the press release. So I was reading.
I thought you were joking. Jamie
Bologna. Wait, you thought I was joking?
I didn't think this was really true. Jamie Bologna, our producer, just brought this in.
The actual press release.
The actual press release from George Santos' office.
You thought I was making that up?
I thought you were making a joke.
No.
That he actually claimed he was sworn in.
By the Speaker.
By the Speaker of the House.
And there's no Speaker, and he wasn't sworn in.
The whole news cycle today is about the fiasco, and he's
I think he missed that part of it.
A press release.
Let's go to Paul.
Oh, my God.
Paul in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Paul. Hi.
Hey, thanks, Marjorie and Jim.
Hey.
These people certainly put the fun in dysfunctional, don't they?
I guess so. Yeah.
I don't understand. There absolutely seems to be no ability to either think critically or introspectively. They caused this, and they're wondering how it happened.
Well, you know, also strategically, after the probably the most effective speaker in the history of the House, whether you like her policy or not, Nancy Pelosi, you have a guy. I was just reading a text during the break from, what was the name of the woman who was, Jen Psaki,
yes,
who was the press secretary for Biden for the first 2 years. And she texts, and I'm paraphrasing, every leader knows you don't have a vote unless you know you have the votes. You always put it off and off. You don't go through the humiliation once, twice, three times.
Right.
And not only is it an embarrassment in the short run, but for those who've said, Paul, this is a harbinger of very bad things to come over the next couple of years in the House, I think are getting it right. Paul, thanks for the call.
I mean, the people that made fun or disliked Nancy Pelosi all these years, I mean, can you imagine? This was never in a million years.
Exactly.
The vote counter is extraordinaire. Your buddy Borowitz said that the problem for McCarthy is he failed math.
I saw that.
In second grade.
I saw that.
He's still trying to recover.
You know who's not a vote counter now for the Democrats? Catherine Clark.
That's right.
Catherine Clark is the whip. That's, I think that's the title. The number two woman
in
the House.
I'm not sure, but she's a
yeah.
big
number
deal.
Number two person
big
in
deal.
The Democratic side of the House. Top ranking woman in the House.
Margo from New Hampshire. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Margo.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
Good. So I know your first caller is right. This is a kind of a sad day for us as a country.
Yes.
It doesn't bode well. It makes
However.
Us look ridiculous. However, I cannot stop laughing.
I know.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's totally hilarious. I mean, the whole George Santos thing, the tripping over themselves. They are ridiculous. I just, you know, I am reveling in it. I mean, right or wrong, good or bad, it's just ridiculous.
Maggie
overall.
from Worcester, Margo, says she made a bowl of popcorn between the second and third votes yesterday, like you were watching some Comedy Central.
Margo, I don't know if you're watching the whole deal, but every time someone like Chip Roy, he's from Texas, right? Chip Roy from Texas.
I think so.
And Matt Gaetz, who probably should be indicted, but wasn't.
What'd you
from
call
Florida.
McCarthy? A slippery alligator?
An alligator.
He can't clean
and
out
he
the
knows
swamp
alligators, right.
when the chief
alligators but you know, when they gave their speeches nominating someone, was it both Jim Jordan? I can't remember. Someone other than McCarthy. Did you notice, Margo? They're standing 3 feet away
yeah.
from McCarthy, who has to keep smiling,
yep.
pretending like
yep.
he's having a great day. By the way, that anybody would be. That's a tough situation. But I'm with you. Bad for America, good for entertainment. Margo, thanks for the. Thanks for the call.
Ted from Marshfield says, voting for Republicans is like injecting bleach to fight COVID. If this fiasco doesn't convince people to stop voting for the GOP, I give up.
You know, I want to repeat what I confirmed with Ayanna Pressley, and I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know it, I think, till yesterday or the day before. Until there's a speaker, nothing happens
nothing.
In the House of Representatives. As Congresswoman Pressley mentioned, she is not sworn in yet, unlike George Santos, who thinks he was sworn in. But was not sworn in. No member of the House has been sworn in, either a reelected person like Pressley or a newly elected person like George Santos. No committees, no hearings, no act. They can't do anything. There is total freeze, total paralysis until they choose a speaker.
Astrid in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Astrid. What's up?
So, and I too am privately maybe smiling about the situation. Mm-hmm. However, I would just caution maybe not to go too hard on the all politicians are liars and terrible. Because here's the thing. The vast majority of politicians aren't. Catherine Clark is an honorable woman. Ayanna Pressley is an honorable woman. Charlie Baker was an honorable man. And
wait a second. One of us say all politicians are liars?
I don't think we said all politicians. I think people say that they're all liars.
Oh, okay.
And they're not all liars. You're absolutely right.
But go ahead, Astrid.
And that's what I would just encourage you to say is that there are so many who are good because then it puts it into stark relief. When you do get somebody like Mr. Santos or whatever his name is today, and, you know, it's just, it makes me profoundly sad, the whole situation with McCarthy, because it, again, this is a man who has very suspect ethics and morals, and he's going to be leading, well, we think, maybe leading that body. And I think that we, maybe just reminding us that the vast majority of people who are in politics, which Robert Reich said, this is community in practice, is that's what politics is. And I think that the vast majority of politicians are good and honorable people who are trying to do what they think is right. Perhaps they get a little bit, fascinated with the power, but the vast majority of people in politics are really good. And it's very sad.
I'm glad
thing is just very sad.
I'm glad you said that,
Astrid.
Well,
you know
Astrid,
what it
thanks.
Also is? It's embarrassing. I mean,
for the country.
We are the United States of America here. We are the supposed, you know, the city on the hill, the beacon of light. I mean, all that. And you just look at the rest of the world thinking, what has happened to these Americans?
You know, I don't want to in any way defend the Republicans in the House, particularly the 140-ish who voted to not certify the election results. But you know how this country's history would have been different if people like Mitch McConnell in particular had had the courage of his convictions and voted to convict Donald Trump. And if he had voted to convict, there would have been enough additional numbers of Republicans to reach the threshold. He would have been convicted in his impeachment trial. He would have been barred from future federal office. Kevin McCarthy, and again, this is not to praise him, it's to damn him, would not have had to travel as a sycophant to Washington. The vast majority of Republicans wouldn't have had to vote on the way they vote on any of these things, because they'd be free of the fear that they feel of this probably soon-to-be indicted former president.
That's one of the biggest questions I have, is why didn't McConnell,
I have no idea,
Lindsey Graham,
I have no idea,
Kevin McCarthy, why didn't they all, or at least a big bunch of them, get together after January 6th and say, we have to be united now. We got to stop this train. I assume
their attitude was the Trumpists are still going to be out there. But if he couldn't run for office, he wouldn't get as much media play. And ultimately, like is happening now, he's beginning to fade from view. I mean, he has no campaign since he announced that he was running for a second term as president. I think that's what would have happened. So history could have been changed in a very positive direction had one man, Mitch McConnell, had the courage to vote the way he spoke on January 6th. By the way, two things. One, we will monitor for you what's going on with the speaker vote in the House, which is supposed to start at noon, so you'll hear it here. And secondly, Marjorie will be personally monitoring everything George Santos does, everything he thinks, everything he
wears.
There's
something in human
nature. He was wearing a backpack yesterday.
That makes people attracted to people that are mean and nasty and call people horrible names and do terrible things like Trump did. Like McCarthy, people were attracted by that, and they were attracted by Trump. But at some point, it goes too far. And I agree with that. I don't know if this is the point that it goes too far, where people say enough is enough. And I feel like I need to take a bath every time I listen to some of these people. I don't know if this is the point, but I'm hoping we get.
Can I interrupt because you have a programming note, because we're almost out of time? What? Marjorie will be doing a 6-hour special on George Santos. It'll be available tomorrow and every day this week, actually, at 2 o'clock, immediately after the
Marjorie
show.
Marjorie will not.
If you had the time.
However, coming up, Boston Globe columnist Marcela Garcia joins us to discuss how more immigration, might help some of America's economic problems, particularly involving inflation. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy. In her latest column for the Boston Globe, Marcela Garcia makes an economic case for bolstering immigration in the U.S. on the heels of comments made by Fed Chair Jerome Powell. We'll get her take on that, plus congressional efforts to ban the social media giant TikTok, where her dog is a superstar. Then it's former state senator, I think as of today, actually, former candidate for governor, Sonia Chang Diaz, on Massachusetts politics without her, for now at least.
I'm Marjorie Egan. There's a new biopic out in theaters centered on the life of the great Whitney Houston, plus a new movie featuring Tom Hanks playing a cranky old man. Otto, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen weighs in on both, plus in theaters, what's going on around town, and what can you do when your town is overrun by coyotes? We'll talk with naturalist Cy Montgomery before getting your thoughts. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, hour number 2, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there. And just a reminder, as we speak, the House is reconvening for the fourth vote to elect a speaker. We'll continue to bring you updates both on that, and Marjorie, of course, will bring you any update on George Santos.
That's right.
No matter what he does or says, she is all over it. Joining us now on Zoom is Marcela Garcia. Marcela is associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Happy New Year, Marcela.
Happy New Year to you guys, too. Thank you for having me.
Are you as consumed by this George Santos thing as Marjorie is, by the way?
No, I mean, I just realized that she's on this beat.
I'm on the beat. That's right. We want to know what his name is today. We want to know if he's any idea what he's doing down there. We want to know why he sent a press release saying he'd just been sworn into Congress when, of course, no one was sworn in because they have no speaker. But anyway, that's not why you're here.
You, thank God.
That's right. You wrote a terrific column. We have talked about this over and over again, the labor shortage, whether it was on Cape Cod this summer or whether we talked with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, about nursing homes. You talked about many when people come here from other countries and they're trying to get a foothold in so-called jobs Americans won't do deal. There's a real connection between the labor shortage and immigration. So tell us what you said.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I feel like every day I come across a new data point, a new take, a new opinion piece, a new article that basically makes the same argument. Just yesterday, Foreign Affairs had a piece by two business professors, one at Tufts, I think, and the other one at the Harvard Business School, saying the same thing. There is a connection between immigration and inflation. And that is through the labor supply. We're short 4 million workers. Some of them are just not going to come back to the labor market, right? Between retirements, between COVID deaths, we just are in need of workers. And I'm sure you get this too. Every day also I see of businesses closing because they cannot find enough workers. Mm-hmm. Just yesterday I found out a beloved restaurant in JP is closing because of that.
Oh, and which one?
Dogwood, the Dogwood.
Oh,
I know, right on Forest Hill. So it's just interesting that the political sort of, you know, class is just so hell-bent on getting political points and just sort of grandstanding on immigration. And they rather just sort of point to the border as chaos, quote unquote, and open borders, you know, if you listen to the right-wing media or the right-wing commentary, when in reality, immigration has been really flat for the past couple of decades. And this is why we have an issue right now. And as we perhaps look ahead towards a potential recession, and it's just insane that we're not using this lever, which is more immigration, more immigrants.
You know, the thing I don't understand, we used to speak to Ali Nirani every few weeks, who was head of the National Immigration Forum before he left. He's did fabulous work.
Who just had a baby, by the way.
Oh, he did?
Oh, he did?
He just had a baby.
Oh, good for him. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Terrific. The thing, you know, you did a variation on a theme. You quoted a guy who's not exactly a left-wing extremist, the head of the Fed, Jerome Powell, saying we have a real problem when there's no immigration and there's an adequate number of workers that fuels inflation. Big business, which owns the Republican Party, and they are the obstacle to immigration reform. I don't get the disconnect. If big business and a guy who big business respects, Jerome Powell, says this is one of the keys to fix the economic mess in this country, why are the Republicans, who are so beholden to these big business guys for the most part, why are they? I mean, I looked up a poll this morning. Just
this is a great poll.
Wouldn't solve the immigration problem, but it's one small. I mean, the worker shortage, but the Dreamer issue, because they're already here. So, Dreamers, listen to these numbers who approve of creating an earned path to citizenship for Dreamers. And for those who don't know, I assume you all know, little kids were brought here usually by their parents.
They're now illegal or undocumented.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they spent their whole lives here, not in their country of birth, just like your kid or their kid or whatever, that kind of thing. 71% support for the legislation, 82% Democrats, 73% independents, even 58% Republicans. That's only a small slice of the immigration thing. So my incredibly long-winded question is, why are Republicans such holdouts when their key constituency is right where you say they are?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the business community, because right at the end of last year, there was a very slim chance that at least Dreamers were going to get protected. But there were also other bills that big business was backing. The Farm Modernization Act, which would have legalized a lot of, hundreds of thousands of farm workers too. That was huge. That had the full backing of the business community, and yet nothing happened. Same thing with the Dreamers. Nothing happened. And I think On the Republican side, I mean, we're seeing it again with what's going on with the Speaker of the House and that battle that's, you know, become intractable. It's because the Republican Party is being held hostage by a handful of people. Now, on the Democratic side, things aren't better or are not as they should be. You know, for instance, I'll give you an example. President Biden, to the best of my knowledge, to people who are in contact with the White House, people who have reported on these things, the White House didn't really make a big push for Congress for these bills to pass. If Biden had put his full weight behind these bills, maybe we would have been looking at a different outlook right now. They just let them die, and it needs the full backing of Biden. It needs the bully pulpit that he has access to. Maybe that would have made a difference, but they didn't do anything. And so I think both parties are at fault here. Again, the Republicans, because they're beholden to this very small constituency, but very radical, that is more interested at keeping the border a problem and an issue. And, you know, they talk about border security when the border really is very secure. Even when these bills had concessions about border security, they were going to increase border security funding by a lot of millions of dollars. That didn't even make a difference. And here we are.
We're talking to Marcela Garcia, Boston Globe columnist. Marcela, why did Biden blow it? Why did he not make more of an issue about this bill?
This is a million-dollar question. I think he's just very, very conservative in how he's being perceived by independents, but yeah, by people who are not MAGA Republicans, people who are moderate Democrats. I think that's really who he is. And people around him, I think, are also taking that clue. And they were very, very cautious around border issues. You know, first it was the elections. They didn't want to do anything before the elections. And now it's like, you know, they have the Senate, but they don't have the House. And so it is astonishing to me why they wouldn't push for these bills to pass. I think that he was just really scared about being vulnerable going into 2023 and thinking about re-election, honestly. And so that's become the calculation. But I also think that Biden really is that moderate Democrat that we have always known him to be.
Well, I would argue that on a whole variety of fronts, I think that analysis may be true in general, but I think he took some positions that maybe didn't fit the narrower profile of a Senator Biden in some of the legislation that did end up passing, particularly on climate. Having said that, we had Gina McCarthy on with us yesterday, who's the former climate advisor to Biden, was the head of the EPA under a Boston woman under Obama. And Marjorie and she were talking, and you brought up the point we often bring up with Bill McKibben, is if you can't do everything you need to do federally, you do it locally. Talking about immigration, you wrote a great piece about immigrant entrepreneurs and how something is being done locally to address one of the obstacles that stood in the way of them doing what they're hell-bent in a wonderful way on doing. Describe that to us, Marcela, if you would.
Yeah, so it's interesting, too, because this week just I came another data point that highlights the great importance of immigrant entrepreneurship in our country. And I'll just cite this. This is a new report from the National Bureau of Economic Research. Of course, this didn't make it into my column, but this report found that 36% of the innovative output of the past three decades can be attributed to immigrants.
Wow.
When the foreign-born only account for 16% of the country's inventors. So they're way more productive that that U.S. native born scientists and innovators. And so that to me has always been remarkable. There are many, many studies that back this. And so locally, that's also true. And I wrote about this nonprofit that I think is always punching above its weight because they have a small budget, but they do amazing things with what they have. English for New Bostonians, they basically partner with companies, with schools to offer free or low-cost English classes to immigrants. And as you know, English classes are not exactly abundant in Massachusetts. There's always a wait list. There are many, many barriers for immigrants to learn English. Cost, you know, they work. etc. So English for New Bostonians does, you know, does this. And so, but they created a new program specifically targeted to entrepreneurs. And so it's called English for Immigrant Entrepreneurs. And it's just teaching English business technical terms. Sure. You know, all this sort of like business units, marketing, how to write a business plan in English, like all these language sort of terms that people don't know about. And so they held an event. English for New Bostonians is celebrating or was celebrating its 20th year anniversary in 2022. And they held like a Shark Tank type of event. You know, for people who had participated in the class, and so they presented their product or their business idea, and then they gave them, I think, $5,000. The woman who won is a Colombian entrepreneur who has a storage and organization business, as you know, that's sort of like in fashion, you know, to hire someone to come and clean and organize your pantry and so that it looks nice and clean. So she does this. And so in the beginning, she only had clients who spoke Spanish. And so she realized that she needed to learn English to expand. And thanks to English for New Bostonians, she was able to do it. Now the majority of her clients are English speaking. And what she wants to do with the money that she won in this competition is to create classes to teach mm-hmm. other women to do this, because she herself was a house cleaner. And so she believes that house cleaners are sort of natural, is a natural fit for them to become organizers or storage organizers. And believe me, there's a huge, huge demand out there for people, women who have no time. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
I would use it.
Yes.
So
if you can't afford Marie Kondo to come to your house, this is what you essentially do.
Exactly.
You know, Marcella, we knew a lot about you. We had no idea that someone so close to you was a huge TikTok influencer. Could you tell us which member of your family is a huge, we watched this about 20 times this morning. Tell us which member of your family is a huge TikTok influencer, please.
So my dog, Santo, not the crazy puppy, the 9-year-old yellow lab, went viral on TikTok. I actually wrote a column about this in 2021 in April. He went viral, and it's been an interesting time. On many levels, right? But on a very basic level, I realized how sad it was that nothing I will ever write will ever garner as many views as this lovely video of my dog. God, it has like more than 9 million views.
Explain,
right?
By the way, explain what Santo is doing in the 15
seconds. It's great. It's great.
Santo goes on hikes. And there's a local business that you know, we take him. And before the pandemic, we used to drop him off. And then, you know, they would take him on hikes. And then they started offering pickup and drop-off service. The little van would come in. And because my husband and I were at work, we would give them a house key. And they would come in, get Santo, take him on a hike, and return him to the house safely, whatever. When the pandemic began, they started doing pickup and drop-offs again. But they wouldn't come in the house. So we would do the handoff, and we were working from home. And so we started doing this thing when the van would show up and Santa would just, you know, wait patiently, super excited, tail wagging at 1,000 miles per hour, waiting for the bus, you know, the little van, not a bus, to arrive. And then she opens the door and he goes in his little cage. And so it's like, you know, kid going to school and getting on the school bus, but he's so patient. And so I think that's what, you know, captured people's, you know, attention.
Oh, he's very well trained, obviously, Marcella, because he's at the top of the stairs. He's not running down the stairs
he's
and getting in the van.
He's vibrating at the top
the tails,
of the stairs.
Like you say, going 90 miles an hour. He looks like he has a little vest on or something. Is that to
identify? Yeah, he has like a harness.
Yeah,
you
a little
know,
harness. And then when the guy opens or the woman opens I couldn't tell if it was a man or woman. Opens
the
little crate. Santos goes in. It goes flying in there. It is a
And to this day, he still does it. To this day, every time I post that video on TikTok, the same video, a different day, it goes viral.
Okay.
Like
so
thousands of views.
But you make a great point in your column, not just because of your dog, Santo, but because this, I don't want do TikTok, but my daughter is always sending me things from TikTok. And the best ones are dog videos. I'm sorry. I
100%.
Just absolutely love them.
100%.
And this is taking away a great source of joy if we ban this stuff, right?
I agree 100%. Also, it's such a source of or an outlet for creativity for people who typically are not creative types.
Yeah.
And you're right. Dogs go viral on TikTok because they're just funny creatures. Yeah. And people just like when you catch something like that, it just goes viral. And you're right. I mean, who doesn't derive joy from something like that, right? Like,
it's great.
It's the same as like someone falling. Like, that's a whole nother genre.
Oh, doesn't get any better than that.
Right?
Falling Why into a fountain so in a funny? Mall. I can watch that about 10.
I would read an article pathetic. As to why do we find that so funny. I mean, I could, like, watch them. On. And so, again, I mean, it's a huge source of entertainment, especially during the pandemic. I mean, it's no secret that TikTok blew up in popularity and user base during the pandemic because we were home,
yeah.
You know, we were isolated, and then all of a sudden you had this at your fingertips. And so, you know, we're part of that. And so actually one of my 2023 resolutions is to post most videos of Santo on TikTok, because people then demand content from you. People get very, yes, they're like, oh, we haven't seen you in such a long time. Gosh. Where have you been? Post more often. And I'm like, I have a job.
Hey, but there was a serious backdrop to introducing us to Santo and his 10 million viewers, which was the whole debate that's going on. I don't know if Trump started the debate, but essentially the debate that's going on about what to do. TikTok is owned by a Chinese company. I assume most people know that. And there's concern about surveillance and that sort of thing. You come down on the non-banning side. Could you explain what the controversy is and why you're where you are?
This is the policy aspect of that column. And yes, it kind of started with Trump, because if you remember, he threatened to ban TikTok because of China. He wanted to appear tough in China, which is a thing that Republicans love to do, just on principle. They want to look tough in China. But in reality, I mean, this is not to say that TikTok doesn't pose legitimate technological safety and, you know, security concerns. But banning TikTok from the U.S. is just not the right solution to this issue, because it's much more bigger than we realize. There's a lot to do in the space of regulating technology companies, foreign owned companies like TikTok. But just banning a single app is just not going to solve the issue. You know, it may win you political points. Now, I am in favor of banning TikTok or other social media platforms for that matter from government-owned devices. That's pretty sensible, which Congress has already done.
Yeah.
And well, some states too, by the way. Many, many states have also done that, which is perfectly sensible. This is not your personal iPhone or your personal smartphone. This is a taxpayer thing. And more importantly, it could be a security issue when you're, you know, doing government business, or, you know, you can't have social media pure. I mean, private companies do this all the time too, just for productivity purposes, right? Nobody wants to be looking at Facebook, you know, on your company issued device. So, but that's separate from the bigger issue, which is we need to do a better job regulating technology companies because there are data threats. But, you know, it should be a blanket thing, not a case, you know, we shouldn't just ban one app from U.S. users.
Do you know, by the way, speaking of banning TikTok from government computers, I'm assuming since you work at the Boston Globe, you remember when Boston City Hall had to ban pornography from from computers at City Hall. Do you remember that, Marcela Garcia?
I don't remember that.
That may have been before her
yes,
time.
Yes, they did.
They couldn't get any clerks to come out to help people at the
when
at the,
was
this? This was like 20 years ago. It was a long time ago. And then once they banned the pornography,
story,
the clerks started to come out. And so they, you know, people were waiting to get someone to help them with their parking tickets for hours. You know what I mean?
We're talking to Marcela Garcia.
But anyway, so before we get into another topic, animal topic, the coyotes, I wanted to ask you about something. We hear all the time about the wage gap between men and women, but the wage gap between white men and Latina women is really startling. So tell us about this.
Yeah, I wanted to write about this in December because December 8th, I think, is the day that honors or, you know, it's not a celebration, but it's a day that marks the Latina wage gap, only because it takes that many days. Like if you count from January 1st to December 8th, it takes that many extra days in the year to make the same amount of money that a white man does for you know, working only 1 year. So almost 2 years, almost double, you know, Latinas have to work in order to make the same money as men. And so I wanted to obviously mark the occasion, but also raise awareness of the, you know, these facts. It's among the worst. I think only Native American women have it worse than Latina women in terms of pay gaps in this country. But there are, you know, there are different policy solutions that the federal government can do. You know, which I think actually passed, if I remember correctly, the Pregnancy Protection Act. I think Congress did end up passing it. If I remember correctly, I should have checked. But for instance, that is a protection for women in the workplace that would, you know, we wouldn't close the gap entirely, but it would probably narrow it a little bit. And so I wanted to also talk about potential solutions at the federal level that could also narrow or bridge this gap a little bit. But honestly, I just really wanted to highlight this incredible disparity because, you know, we talk about obviously women disparities in wages, but when you drill down to ethnicities and racial disparities, it just gets much more worse.
Okay, apparently Jim has informed me we have to wait on coyotes until next time.
We'll do coyotes next time.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk with Tom Montgomery about the coyotes.
They're not here. Are they in your neighborhood? I can't remember from your...
Yes,
are they in your neighborhood?
Yes, they are.
100%. So in one sense, are you in favor of what's happening in the hunt where they're going to kill some of these damn animals?
Oh, yes and no. It's more complicated than that. But I don't want them eating dogs.
Exactly.
No, we agree, especially Santo.
Santo!
No,
Santo,
I don't want
horrible.
Them. No, that's not. Yeah. So whatever you have to do, I mean, I think there are more solutions than just killing them, but absolutely not. They should not be in your backyard, period.
They should not be in your backyard,
Fair
period.
Enough.
That's absolutely right.
So we'll be following Santo. We're not going to read all your columns, Marcella. We're busy. But
what?
We will
I'm
be
fine.
Following Santo on
I'm
TikTok. Take care. It's
Thank
great
you.
To see you, Marcella.
Thank
Garcia.
You so much, Marcella.
Me.
Happy New
Thanks.
Year. Marcella Mark Garcia is associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe.
You got to watch this
and
TikTok.
And the mother
bit.
Of a very famous dog, whose name is Santo. You can see Santo on TikTok. Okay, coming up, former state senator Sonia Chang Diaz is going to join us to discuss what's going on Beacon Hill and what's going on for her after serving in the state senate since 2008. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Joining us in studio, my God, that's radical. Former state, well, I don't know. You're not former state senator until the end of the day, are you? Or are you?
I'll be honest, Jim. I'm not entirely sure. You know, yesterday was my last day on payroll.
Okay.
So I think, you know, but, and I think Liz was just sworn in. Yeah, so
you should maybe say who that voice belongs to.
Yes.
Former state senator, we think former. She's not sure.
No.
Either.
Once Liz is sworn in, I'm a former.
State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, former public school teacher, and Lynn, right? Am I right
That's
about
right.
that?
Lynn,
yeah.
That's right.
She served in the state senate since 2008, was the first Latina and first Asian American state senator in Massachusetts history. Obviously, she ran for the Democratic nomination. For governor against Maura Healey. Senator Chang Diaz, it's good to see you. How you been?
You too. No one would accuse me of running for the Republican nomination.
No, they would not.
Well,
would
speaking
not.
Of Republicans, before we get into what you're doing.
George Santos.
You know, when you first became a state senator, you know, you're going to get sworn in. It's a great celebratory day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Family members come or friends, everybody gets dressed up, take pictures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine having gone to Congress yesterday to expect to be sworn in with your family or your babies or whoever it was and go through this fiasco that they went through yesterday?
It does sound fairly crushing for the new members and the,
yeah.
you know, the families who've, you know, made it through the gauntlet of an election for the first time. To not have that august, you know, moment of this. I mean, one would imagine in this case probably, you know, new incoming members and families were probably braced for this chaotic reality yesterday and maybe had planned accordingly. But it's a shame for them.
You know, we were talking to Anna Presley earlier today about the, what'd you call it, the estrogen surge?
Estrogen surge
the, you know,
in Massachusetts,
the huge number
that's
of
right.
women in positions of leadership where there hadn't been before, from City Hall to obviously Beacon Hill, all that sort of thing. We did the math this morning, which I'm sure you know. The state senate in progressive Massachusetts, unless I made a mistake calculating, is it four people of color as you leave? Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, it's our new high water mark. Is
so
four.
Exactly what I was going to say. High water mark is 10% of the damn Senate are people of color. Where's the disconnect?
Well, and I have to give some context on that, Jim. Like, I hear the disapproval in your voice, and I share it, right? We should be further along. But I have to say, when, you know, four feels like I've died and gone to heaven. You know, when I came in, I was the only one. And for much, if not a majority of my 14 years in the Senate, I was the only member of color. And when Adam Gomez from Springfield came last term, it was, you know, just such a tall glass of water for me. And so I can't even imagine the luxury of having four. You know? It's sweet and bitter, you know.
So let's deal with the bitter. What's taken? Why is it so slow? Of course, we would have said to you, I don't know, a couple of years ago, why haven't we had a woman governor? Why haven't we had a woman mayor? And so I guess that's changed too. So what is taking so long? It seems so out of step with the progress that is being made throughout Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is so out of step. But politics are a lagging indicator. And so we're... You know, when you see economic disparities in the larger population, in other forms of power, whether it's financial power, power in boardrooms, representation in the media, right, we're going to see those show up in our electoral numbers as well. And I have to say, you know, even though I celebrate and I am thrilled at the estrogen surge that we are seeing in statewide offices in Massachusetts here, that the numbers of women in the legislature have been pretty stagnant, you know, over my time in office. I think we're still hovering around a quarter.
Wow.
So, you know, we've got a lot of room to grow there, too.
So when you look back on your time up at the state Senate, what do you remember most fondly? What are you most proud of?
Well, those might be two different answers. What do I remember most fondly and what am I most proud of? You know, I mean, they're overlapping, of course, but what do I remember most fondly is the people that I have been incredibly blessed to work with. There have been about 40 incredibly talented, mostly pretty young staff members who have graced my office over my 14 years. People who have, you know, who took 50% or in some cases like 80 or 90% pay cuts to come work in the public sector, to come work for me in a, you know, job with long hours and underappreciation from, I think, the general public because they believe in public service and they have a heart for it and they believe in being seekers of justice and just incredible, incredible people. And I'm also it overlaps into your other question about what am I most proud of. You know, the first thing that usually comes to mind, my mind, and I think other people's minds in answering that question, is the legislation. But I have to say, you know, having had a small part of putting an incredible pipeline of talent, you know, into public service in Massachusetts, a lot of women, a lot of people of color have come through my office over those years and have gone on to do wonderful other things in public service and advocacy and organizing. So incredibly proud of that, too. But legislatively, you know, I think I got to give the top spot to the Student Opportunity Act. You know, that's my baby.
Yeah, explain that to people.
So this was a major overhaul in our K-12 education financing system in Massachusetts. The last time we had really touched the way that we do K-12 financing was over a quarter century ago in Massachusetts, and made some really big progress at the time in 1993, but didn't really come back and revisit, you know, is it working? And we made some pretty big assumptions in 1993 about what it would take to close opportunity and achievement gaps. And we got those assumptions wrong. It was a best effort, but we got them wrong. There was a lot we didn't know. And there was an abundance of data piling up in the intervening years saying, look, it takes more effort than we thought it would to close really cavernous inequality in our society, in our country, and even here in our Commonwealth, we're not immune. And so the Student Opportunity Act was our, you know, it was a 4, 5, 6 year process, or a, you know, multi-decade process, depending on when you start the clock, to get it right. And what we did was basically double the state's investment in our highest poverty students in Massachusetts, our highest density poverty communities in Massachusetts. And that's – we started phasing it in. Over the, it was passed in 2019. It was a 4 or 5 year battle. I've got the scars from it. But it's – that money is starting to hit the streets now. And while I was on the gubernatorial campaign trail, I had the opportunity to talk to teachers and superintendents all across the state. And I asked them, you know, what are you starting to spend those dollars on? And almost every single one of them would say social-emotional support services, wraparound services for students.
Well, you taught in Lynn, mm-hmm. and Lynn is not a wealthy town. It's not.
No, it is not.
When you say wraparound services, you mean for kids who are having issues, having trouble at home or having trouble in...
Just living, right?
Yeah, just living, right? I mean, this is something that I heard nonstop for years, you know, for I don't know how many years it was, maybe 8 years. I served as the chair of the education committee in the legislature. And over that time, you know, increasingly every year I would hear with greater intensity from school leaders, you know, what is the thing that they need most? What are they grappling with most? And they would say, you know, the trauma and the social-emotional problems that students, and not just sort of boutique, you know, kids on the margins, but just students in general, just living, right, are bringing into the schools. It's just they're carrying so much weight. And, you know, talking about Lynn, during the work to get the Student Opportunity Act passed, we took a delegation of folks, including some of the New England Patriots who were stumping for the bill, back to the Lynn Public Schools to visit and to see what the realities were. And we talked to, coincidentally, Dr. Tutwiler, who's now the Secretary of Education, who was the superintendent of Lynn at the time. And I asked him, you know, what is the student to social worker or school counselor ratio in the Lynn Public Schools. And I kid you not, he said it was 700 and something to
God.
One.
Oh, my God.
And the jaws of the Patriots players and everybody else on this tour just dropped, you know, 730 something, let's say, to one. And, imagine your child in that situation. And you know, I'm not saying that with the Student Opportunity Act that that number is going to drop to 100 to 1, you know, overnight. But there are, without a doubt, kids across the state, whether it's in Lynn or in Worcester or Springfield or Holyoke or New Bedford, who have school counselors, school psychologists, maybe a reading specialist this year that didn't last year or 2 years ago because of the Student Opportunity Act.
You know, I always think of when there was some kind of bad thing that happened somewhere in a more affluent suburb, they talked about how they were going to have the counselors in there the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go into the Boston schools. I don't know much about the Lynn schools, but I used to cover the Boston schools. You go into the Boston schools and you ask how many of you knew someone who'd been shot, and half the class mm-hmm. hands go up. And, you know, they mm-hmm. weren't getting the person in there, but the more wealthy districts mm-hmm. were getting them or had them there all the time.
Yeah.
Can I interrupt one second? We promised updates. There are now enough votes for Representative Byron Donalds. He's a Republican from Florida.
I've never heard of him. You?
Well, he actually was the 20th vote. Remember we talked about there were 19 votes not for McCarthy yesterday? He became the 20th on the third ballot. He's a candidate. He's got 8 votes, which is obviously more than 4, which means that McCarthy will be denied the speakership yet again
on the
fourth ballot. We'll let you know. You know, one of the things, I don't mean, it's kind of you to come in, so I don't mean to be critical, but you're here, so I'll say it. I was very disappointed. One of the things was not a priority for you. Obviously, a 5-month vacation for the legislature is not enough. Why didn't you attempt to expand the 5-month to 6 or 7? She's looking at me like, what is he talking? How can you know? I know it's not, you're not that, you were not the president of the Senate or the speaker of the House. How does one, Charlie Baker would sit mm-hmm. where you're sitting mm-hmm. and with a straight face mm-hmm. say he thought it was a good reform that the legislature was out of session for 5 months.
Yeah.
And I'm begging you, don't tell me how hard you were working at home and talking to your constituents. I'm sure you were. What justification is there for
you
the
damn legislature? You love getting me to agree with Charlie Baker, Jim.
I'm serious. You are going to agree?
Yes, it goes against my grain, of course. But no, look, I think it's important to acknowledge the agreements when we have them. This reform was a good government reform when it was rolled out because, you know, too many shenanigans were happening close to election time. And, you know, people are under this, and I know you're not, Jim, I know you get it, right? But I think many folks in the general public are under this impression that when we are not in the Senate chamber or in the House chamber that we're, you know, like eating bonbons on the beach or something, right? That's the only place we do work is in that one room. But when we are not voting on a bill in the chamber, there's, you know, 100 other forms of work that go into legislating.
But important bills that have even one dissenter out of 200 legislators can't become law if that one dissenter chooses the common exercise his or her vote, right?
Yes.
I mean, you need unanimous consent for virtually everything.
Yes.
Not virtually, but everything.
Yes, that is 100% true. But it is also the case that during the time from, you know, July 31st to December 31st, right, the time period that we just ended, that an enormous amount of work is going on, whether it's, you know, for legislators to get back to their districts and be in touch with the people that they are supposed to be working for and representing, and doing R&D on new legislation, right? I can't tell you what a hustle there is going on right now in legislators' offices to, you know, finalize the language of the bills that they're going to be filing in a few weeks. And that, you know, like, we want legislators to put thoughtful work and research into the things that they're
talking about. Outgoing State Senator Sonia Cheng Diaz, you know, you mentioned you were chair of the Education Committee. I hesitate to do this because it's one of the few issues that Marjorie and I have problems with in studio.
You mean fights about?
About teachers and teachers' unions. You know,
that's because Jim got the President's Award from the Master Teachers Union.
Oh, because I
obviously totally
did
in the
work
tank
that
ever
murdered
since.
It. Okay,
right.
Thank
and
you.
No matter what they do,
regardless,
it's great.
The first part is true. The second part is probably true, too. So the Mass Teachers Association, which represents 100-some thousand educators and all kinds of things. Biggest, there's the Mass Federation of Teachers, for those who don't know. That's the AFL-CIO affiliated union. A little bit smaller. MTA is the biggest one in the state, arguably the most powerful. They're filing a bill and fighting for a bill that would remove the prohibition on public employees from striking except for public safety workers. Mm-hmm. A handful of states, including some big ones like California, allow strikes. Marjorie obviously thinks it's an atrocity. I think it's a basic right for people who were workers. Where are you on this, former education chair?
I'm gonna shock you by landing somewhere in the middle between you two, and this one's a hard one for me. I'll be honest with you because it does call into tension two pretty fundamental values for me. You know, the right to collectively bargain is a fundamental building block in my view, and you know, the right to control over one's work. But I also have this core conviction. Call me, you know, old fashioned or sentimental. Public service is something different. It's something special, and it is a sacred trust. And, you know, I think that the distinction that the legislation makes about public safety employees is an insightful one, right? And this is not to say I don't think that teachers should have the right to strike. I think that there are very few things in the world that are binary. You know, it should just be yes or no. And I think there are some interesting models out there that it's worth looking at in other states that have that do allow for a right to strike for teachers and other public sector workers. But there's a higher threshold, right? There's a step.
Meaning
up
what?
Process.
You may have to go through some sort of arbitration. Or something, mediation prior to
steps,
the strike.
You know, that ensure that it really is a last resort. But, you know, I have spent the last many years, you know, as a legislator and as an organizer, making the case to the public that, you know, we need to have a different conception of how we do public safety, what we conceive of as public safety work in Massachusetts and in America in general, and that it can't just be, you know, force and punishment. And that if we want to get public safety right, it has to be a more expansive definition of prevention and uplift. And, you know, teachers very rightly, I think, have been making the case that they are key to the equation of public safety. And we can't have it both ways, right? And I say this as a former educator, as a former teachers union member, that, you know, I think we're right when we say we are part of the public safety equation, but we also then have to, you know, be there and stand on that line and say, look, you know, the nature of our work is different. And it is more, you know, during the pandemic, we looked upon educators rightfully as essential workers. And essential workers, you know, it is a different kind of labor.
Talking to state senator, former as of yesterday, we think, Sonia Chang Diaz.
I just want to be clear. They do strike, as they just did in Brookline, but they have to pay
heavy
fines.
It's illegal. Well, they strike, but it's illegal. Obviously, right. They can strike. I should have been clear.
Yeah.
Making the right to strike a legal thing you could do. And there's was it Haverhill? They're paying
$100,000 and Brookline. If I had to pay the money back. But, you know, I'm also interested, because I am very interested in education, that I thought one of the things that bothered me about this was that we have heard about the learning loss during the mm-hmm. pandemic. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, it's easier to say, okay, maybe we should have gone back to school early at the time. I understand why it was hard for people to go back to school. But you do wonder, and maybe it gets back to what you talked about with being under-resourced in poor towns. We know there was this terrible learning loss, and mm-hmm. we talked about how there's a need for tutors, a need for more kids to get extra help. And you don't hear about it happening. And I don't understand that. You know, is it the bureaucracy mm-hmm. is too difficult to turn around, like it's a big, huge battleship? Or why? Because it's January now. And what about these kids that are going to graduate in May or June that maybe are like 2 years behind and they're seniors in high school?
Yeah, I mean, it is, as a parent, I worry about this for
sure. How old are your kids, by the way? I don't know.
They are 7 and 9.
Oh, they are. Okay.
7 and 9. And, I think that we don't yet know. I don't know as a parent, and I think we don't yet know as a society and as a body of educators what the full impacts are of the pandemic, whether it's on literacy acquisition or social emotional skills. So I do worry a lot about that, and I will confess that I'm a little bit banging my head against the wall wondering why is it taking so long for the federal ESSER dollars, right?
Huge
amounts of money that have come to the state to help with this problem. You know, it seems to be that they're taking a long time to get out the door and hit the streets. But we have to just appreciate the magnitude of the project here. I mean, the amount that was taken away from educators and children alike during the pandemic, it is immense. And to, expect that teachers are going to be able to sort of turn that around in, 6 months or a year, I don't think is realistic. And I don't think appreciates the just the difficulty of the job, that we expect teachers to do.
Since we have concluded, I think all three of us, you're no longer a state senator. We officially mm-hmm. agree on that now?
Yes.
We should say, you said Liz Miranda is your successor, obviously, as state senator.
And big congrats to her.
Well, and yes, indeed. What are you doing? I know it's day one, but what are you doing?
It's day one. I was going to
Charlie Baker, by the way, would sit there as recently as a few weeks ago. What are you doing, Governor? I have no idea.
No idea.
What's your next
job?
I don't know.
Turns out he had a job offer close to...
Well, we don't know if he had the offer when he said he had no idea. In all fairness,
don't you think they called him in for an interview?
I think they might have called him
in. At least once.
I do not have a secret contract negotiation in the works.
So what are you going
to
do?
I'm just trying to sleep in a couple days. I haven't accomplished that yet this morning. I'm going to take a rest. I have been running at a sprint for 14 plus years, being a legislator and, taking that job seriously, getting the Student Opportunity Act passed, getting, nation-leading police reform legislation passed.
You were also involved in important cannabis reform.
Social equity,
really important, yeah.
Major criminal justice reform. And then, gestating and raising two human beings. So, I'm going to take a little bit of a rest. And then achieve some mental stillness and think about what do I want to do next.
Great.
You know, this is a sexist question, I admit, because I wouldn't ask a man. But I'm a woman. I got three kids. I worked two jobs for a long time. I wonder if part of the reason that there are so few women in the legislature is still the hours. Mm-hmm. It requires being out at night all the time when you got little kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's difficult if you are – I think moms are much more guilty than dads.
It is. It's hard. I'm not going to lie. This is actually one of the things, when we were talking about why haven't the numbers changed more? Why aren't they more equal to the population? One of the pieces of legislation that my great sister in service, Pat Jalen, has been fighting for many years that I hope this next term will be the term, is to allow childcare expenses to be paid for out of campaign funds for people who, for whom that is necessary. This is a barrier to get more women of, mothering years to be able to run for office, let alone be in office.
What's the argument against that, Sonia Chang Diaz?
Oh, people, I don't – I have yet to hear a good one, honestly.
That's a great idea.
That it's, you know, I think it really hinges on this, I think, outdated, you know, notion that childcare is your, you know, that's your personal business.
Yeah, it's your problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shouldn't have the babies, lady.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, run for office later once your children are grown, right? And, you know, there are very few parents of young children, male or female, in the legislature. It's an increasing number. That's something I've definitely seen grow over my time in office. There's an increasing number of them. But, yeah, I think it is there's more judgment still on women. You know, I remember when I was pregnant with my first child, one of the media outlets in my district, which I will not name, asked me about, you know, how much maternity leave was I going to take. And I thought, you know, there's no right answer to that question. And I went back and I looked before I called back the report. I went back and I looked and I said, did they ask that question or run an article about John Connolly, who was in the city council, when he, because he had a
that's
small
right, he had little
and
kids.
They never did. And they never did. And I said, I'll answer that question when you ask the question of John Connolly.
Well, it is a sexist question. I must
admit. What newspaper was it?
No, I won't tell.
Come on.
But you know what always drove me crazy? I remember when Charlie Baker was running for governor. I don't remember his first time or the second time, but you know, they talked about how, he was off. He's watching his kids soccer game, and it drove me insane because when you go to the soccer game and you're the man, you're the great dad. When you go to the soccer game and you're the mother, you're skirting your duties, and that has always driven me insane. So my sympathies.
Congratulations on 14 pretty good years there, and we wish you some peace.
That's some high praise coming from you.
Hope you're back in the fray.
I know, he's so critical.
Right?
I can't get over the 5 month thing. We'll talk about that in the future. Sonia Chang Diaz, congratulations, and it's great to see you. I hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming.
It's
really appreciate
it.
We've been speaking with former state senator Sonia Chang Diaz, and we're very grateful for her for coming into the studio. Coming up, GBH executive arts editor Jared Bowen on a new Whitney Houston movie. I Want to Dance with Somebody. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
It's
we'll
over?
Do the clip.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. I'm going to introduce our next guest as Marjorie introduced him on our promos that we taped this morning. Joining us is Jared Bowen. He is the GOP's executive arts editor. He joins us on Zoom. Congratulations on the new job, Jared. That's fabulous.
Yeah. Well,
you know, my headset wasn't working. I didn't hear your whole intro.
Oh, here it is.
What's my new job?
The way that she described you this morning was he's Jared Bowen. He is the GOP's executive arts editor.
Yeah.
So there you are.
Well, I view myself as improved. I used to be able to fill the so-called blooper reel in a day. Now it takes me at least a week.
I know. It's pretty sad. That development
is unfortunate.
I feel
that I've come a long way since my a bloop a minute.
Are we allowed to ask you where you are or we're not?
I'm coming to you from home right now.
Oh, you are.
I'm trying to organize my GOP strategy. It takes a lot of work to do that. I can't leave the house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Jared Bowen, let's start with this movie. We're going to play a little sound from it, too, from the trailer of I Want to Dance with Somebody. This is about Whitney Houston, of course, and the sound we're going to play you is when the then-unknown Whitney performs before record producer Clive Davis. Here it is.
Special guest in the audience tonight, legendary record executive Mr. Clive Davis.
My voice is gone.
What?
You start the show tonight. No talking back. I'm your mother.
Wow. Okay. So everybody knows the great, great voice of Whitney Houston. How is the...
And the tragic tale of Whitney
Yes,
Houston.
And the tragic tale of her death and her daughter's death. But tell us about the movie. What do you think?
So I think the movie only moderately works well, but what it does very successfully is remind us what an exceptional, extraordinary talent she was, that there absolutely was the reason that she was called the voice. So here you have her family coming together to make this film. Clive Davis is listed as one of the producers. And right from the get-go, you understand that this is going to address Whitney Houston as she was in real life and not just essentially move past the veneer. Right away, we understand that the longtime relationship she had with her best friend, Robin, was of a much more personal nature. So it goes into her sexuality. We see the toll that fame took as her family, her father took over her finances, and she struggled to be a successful artist, but also to be an independent person when her father was controlling all of her money. And then, of course, what happened when Bobby Brown came into the picture and suddenly he had a lot of alcohol and drugs and partying and a whole different lifestyle take hold of her. And all of that is represented here. And she's played by Naomi Ackie, who is a British actor who is pretty extraordinary in the role, except for the fact that she's not singing. It's really a hybrid, I should say hybrid, but it's mostly Whitney Houston's voice and some minor singing by Naomi Ackie.
Well, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, when you're playing someone with the voice, as it were, it almost seems like you have to use her voice.
Well, can I give you an exception? I hate to rave about a play that we saw that when I don't remember the guy's name. Who's the actor who played Neil Diamond, who I don't even
Oh, Will Swenson.
But Will Swenson on, was unbelievable
yeah,
as
but
Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond for it was not the voice
of
Whitney
Houston. That's a very good point.
As you may think he did a great job with Caroline, whatever it is.
Not just Caroline, Sweet Caroline. Sweet Caroline. He was terrific.
He was great. I don't mind that it was her, the real Whitney Houston's voice. Is that a problem?
It's not a problem, but I feel like people should know going in. So in some respect, it almost feels a little bit documentary-esque when you realize that you're hearing Whitney Houston's actually voice, but seeing these fictional representations.
Yeah.
A lot of these films struggle so mightily, I think, biopics, that is, because they just move from one to the next, these moments. And this is why you never really get a true sense of her. And it almost feels a little voyeuristic as unfolding.
So, addressing the issue you two are talking about, I hope I have the name of it right. I was on a plane pre-pandemic somewhere, and I watched an actual documentary, and I think it was called Whitney, but I'm not 100% sure. There was a documentary, not a biopic. And I have to say, not only one of the most incredible, beautiful voices in my whole life, but they're the most intimate images, real images of the pain she was going through, the addiction she was going through. But if you want the real story of her life, I mean, again, it comes with a lot of pain. I would argue that's what you should see. It was terrific.
So do you mind if we hear some of her voice before we move on?
Of course.
This is Whitney Houston singing the song from which the movie gets its title, I Want to Dance with Somebody Who Loves Me. This is off her 87 album, Whitney.
I Want to Dance with Somebody. That's the name of the biopic and obviously of the song. You know, staying in film, we're talking to Jared Bones. Staying in film, is it called Man Called Otto? Is this the latest Tom Hanks deal? Yes?
It is called that, yeah.
And that's a redo of a foreign film? Am I not right about that?
It's a Swedish foreign film based on a best-selling novel, A Man Called Ove.
Ove, okay. And A Man Called Otto... I'm embarrassed to say because I didn't see the Swedish film. And I think it was nominated for Academy Awards.
I watch all Swedish films, yes. Actually.
If it was noir, I would be watching. Swedish noir.
Scandi noir.
I do watch Scandi noir, as everybody knows. I assume some people know. So what is this deal? What's Man Called Otto?
So this is really a sweet film. I think it's been knocked a little bit for being so sweet, but I think it works. And so we find Tom Hanks as this man, Otto, who's living in this very particular neighborhood where he has been invested for his entire life in making sure that nobody, people close the gate when they're supposed to, people shovel their walk when they're supposed to, that they put the trash where the trash goes and the recycling where the recycling goes. But he's also a very grumpy man. And through flashbacks, we begin to understand why he would go to, as the opening scene shows us, he goes into the Busy Beaver hardware store and is beyond upset that he has to pay 33 cents more for a piece of rope because he actually hasn't bought the full 6 feet of rope.
I could deal with that.
But it's because we find that he had met the woman of his dreams and they had this great marriage and she really kept him steady because he has a very particular personality, but we come to understand that he's widowed. And so he doesn't really see a purpose in life anymore after her death, until this young couple with their young kids moves across the street and he begins to understand that there is a little bit more to life. So it's a pretty straightforward story, but we see the thawing of Otto, played by Tom Hanks, and also a really, really terrific performance by Mariana Trevino, who plays the young woman across the street who draws this out of him to make him recognize that there is a life worth living even after such tragedy in his life. She, by the way, is a comedic Mexican star, and she just shines in this film. And I think for that reason, for all of these coming together and to see Otto and thawing and Tom Hanks kind of playing a different role than we've seen him play before. We don't necessarily picture Tom Hanks as grumpy, maybe League of Their Own or something like that. It really works because we need to see this in more people, I think, right now. So it's a perfect time for this film.
Isn't this kid in this thing or I got the wrong movie?
Yeah, his kid Truman Hanks plays his younger self. So in all of these flashbacks where we understand how he and his wife met and what their life was like, his son plays him at a younger age.
Want to play a little sound from Otto?
Sure, why not?
Okay, here's a scene from A Man Called Otto. In this one, neighbors introduce themselves to Otto. And of course, we just mentioned he's played by Tom Hanks.
Hi. We wanted to properly introduce ourselves because, you know, we're going to be neighbors and everything. So,
okay.
Okay.
Bye.
How many people played that role? I mean, I like Tom Hanks, but I mean, how many people played that? Wasn't it Clint Eastwood in some movie?
She hands him a Tupperware dish of food, right? And he just shuts the door right
there.
Because it's in the clip.
Oh, sorry. Okay. What were you going to say?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Clint Eastwood because we have seen this role, of course. But Clint Eastwood brought a lot of edge to it because he was racist.
Yeah, he was. That's right, yeah.
Gran Torino.
Gran Torino. Very good there.
Gran Torino, yeah. And I think what's distinguishing Tom Hanks here is that his character is somebody who is very particular and needed his wife to show him the way of life and to be there by his side because couldn't necessarily function well in society without her. So this, we see a man, and I think we all know people like that who are very dependent in all sorts of lovely ways. And then what happens when that radically changes? And so because of that backstory, I think it's more impactful.
Yeah, I have to say, you both misunderstood me. I wasn't talking about Clint Eastwood. I played that cranky old white man in real life. That's what I was talking about.
That's
that
right.
Scene was actually someone knocked on my door a couple of weeks ago, and that was the end of that.
Open the door, close the door.
Okay.
After he took the food, of course.
I was going to say, there's no rejecting food.
Now, exactly. I'm going to do what Marjorie does and gets away with, and I can do it because it's a guy. Hugh Jackman is one good-looking guy.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I can do that, right?
Yes.
He is really
very handsome.
Good-looking. And he plays the
Music
lead guy.
Man.
Yeah, I saw Music Man. What was that, high school production? I saw Music Man about 10 years ago. I don't know where it was, CRLS, Cambridge Engine. I saw it somewhere. But Hugh Jackman's in a big-time version of this that is around, I think, for 2 more weeks. Tell us where and tell us what you thought.
Yeah, so I just raced down because I realized this was going to be kind of a flaw in my arts editorship if I didn't see Hugh Jackman in The Music Man on Broadway as he is
now.
And I got a second chance because they've just extended to just through January 15th and then the show closes. And also, I've never seen The Music Man. I don't know how that's possible because it is such an iconic Broadway show. So I went down to New York and saw this, and it's delightful. Although I will say that it's a little bit darker than I expected. So for people who don't know the story, he plays Professor Harold Hill, who shows up in River City, Iowa, and has to convince the town that they need to start a boys' marching band. So they need to buy the uniforms and they need to buy the instruments. And this is all to counter the fact that there's a pool table in town. So what does a pool table represent? Mores are going south.
That's right.
So the only way to correct course is to have a marching band. But he's a con man. So really, he's just all about taking the money for the instruments and the uniforms until he meets the town librarian, played here by Sutton Foster, and recognizes that maybe there's a reason he should settle down. But it is a little dark because you know this entire time that he's trying to woo this woman and con the town. But this is a big show. It's the same director who did Hello, Dolly! A few years ago, which took this very old classic show and made it so lively and brought it back to life. And we see much the same with The Music Man. And Hugh Jackman is just, I mean, he's extraordinary to see him on the stage. I'd seen him once before. He played the boy from Oz, doing the story of Peter Allen. And he has just such great magnetism on the stage. You had everybody at the Winter Garden Theater leaping up for an ovation at the end. And again, we're at the end of the run. But he's got this twinkle, too. And he brings the audience in on the act because you're going along with him knowing he's a con man. So there are certain points where he just turns and kind of looks with a little squint in his eye at the audience. And it's very engaging and fun. And so if people can get down there in these last few performances, definitely see it.
Did I mention he's fairly good looking? I can't remember. Did I say that? Oh, my God. I mean, I'm looking at him now.
Still incredibly athletic as he's jumping up and down on stage.
Really?
Well, he's 54 years old. He's not
150. Didn't he do the Academy Awards or something a couple of years ago? He did some big thing that was on TV, but of course...
No, that was Chris Rock. They look a lot alike. That's why they are.
So Jared Bowen, who is not the GOP arts editor, is the GBH arts editor. We've been talking a lot about countries returning looted art. Or not returning it. So what's going on with Egypt and the green coffin sarcophagus?
Yeah, we have another big one. The Houston Museum of Natural Sciences in the United States just sent back a coffin, a sarcophagus called the Green Coffin. It's an ancient wooden sarcophagus back to Egypt. Egypt is hot on this, as we've talked about in the last couple of months, because they're soon to open the Grand Egyptian Museum, which will be near the pyramids, which will be kind of fun to see, because I don't know if anybody's been. I've been to Cairo. I've been to their former museum and to the pyramids.
You have?
And you have
What'd
this,
you think?
Well, you have this conception that the pyramids are out in the middle of the desert. You need to take 14 camels and 15 nights to get there. But you ultimately realize you're passing a couple 7-Elevens and
is that really true?
Strip malls, and all of a sudden there are the pyramids.
Yeah. Oh my God!
They butt right up against the city. But the new museum will be located there. So Egypt has been hot on getting a lot of artifacts back, and for years they were looted, they were ferried out of the country, they were sold by black market dealers, and museums haven't always been on the up and up, as we've also talked about making sure they do the right checks to confirm that these antiquities were gained through proper channels. And sure enough, Houston realized, as this investigation was done, looking at the lineage or the provenance, as museums say, of this piece, they realized that it had to go back.
Let me ask you a question. I'm embarrassed to say I don't know this. Can you go inside the pyramids?
Some.
You can.
Yeah.
Not all, or just some?
I don't know if it's all three. I mean, they're massive, so it takes a lot to walk
around
them.
There are only three pyramids?
Yeah, there are three ones. You've seen pictures of them.
I didn't know there
were
only three.
Right near the Sphinx.
So what's it like when you go inside?
Dark.
It's dark. But what do you see?
At this point, you don't see much. You can go to a place like Luxor.
Because it's been looted.
Down. Exactly.
Okay.
So it's basically this moment where you have some sense. I'm trying to remember now. It was quite a while ago. I think there are still some images very, very faded that you can see.
Yeah.
But it's more about having the experience of actually just going into the pyramid, having a sense of really, as I said, going in, but also being in a chamber. But if you go to a place like Luxor, then you can start to descend into tombs like King Tut's,
okay,
where the wall art has been preserved, and you have a deeper sense of what these chambers were like.
So obviously Marty's interested in the pyramids. I'm interested, how are the 7-Elevens in Egypt? How did you find them to be? Were they
well,
good?
Well, if you can even get into them, because the traffic is so nightmarish. I always think that driving in Boston is like a video game because it's so chaotic and people are a little bit aggressive. And Cairo is about that times 20.
Really?
But this sarcophagus, yeah. When you think about this, it dates from the last, as this piece points out, the last dynastic period of ancient Egypt, which was a time that went from 664 BC until 332 BC. That's 2,500 at least years old, right?
And it should be home, and it should be a symbol of the country where it was taken from. But of course, is a great reflection of their history, and they're able to finally tell the history in great form by having this new museum. That's why it's so important that these pieces go back, but also acknowledging that people have covered up their tracks and they can't get they can't get away with this anymore.
So tell us about this exhibition at Harvard, the Dare to Know: Princeton Drawings in the Age of Enlightenment.
I loved this show. It is on view just through January 15th. And I loved it because, like so much of history, we understand that past is prologue. And so this is really kind of a first of its kind show. And it looks at the Age of Enlightenment between 1720 to 1800 and the role that drawings and prints had in that period. And to put it in modern parlance, you realize that it was the social media of its day, how ubiquitous paper was, so that people could spread messages and try to influence thinking and change thinking, to provoke and to probe. So we're thinking of this time. It's a time when you have great intellectuals, you have people pushing back against religion, you have major revolutions in America and Haiti and France, and then you have artists disseminating on paper things like the brutality of executions. So let's render how brutal these executions are and get them out into the public sphere. And people start to understand, as they see this visualized, how barbaric executions are, and it can sway public opinion. There's another piece that they have, that there was a man who was wrongly imprisoned. And so basically printmakers did their version of a GoFundMe campaign. And they disseminated images of this trial and what it did to this man's family, also that they could raise money for the family for defense causes and just for the family's well-being. One of the last images in the show was of a fiery climate where you have volcanoes erupting, and it looked not unlike what my friend in Hawaii has been texting me, or was texting me last month, as the volcano was erupting there. But these are all means to get the message as far and wide as possible. And through this exhibition at Harvard, they're beginning to understand, as they look at how these materials were used, how they ultimately also shaped society. And they did have an incredible impact.
You know, I'm about to embarrass myself, but I can't resist. Other than like Kant and I think Rousseau, who are like the major figures of the Enlightenment? I mean, who were the major thinkers of the...
Well, I guess Descartes. It was Descartes.
Descartes.
You're talking about Immanuel
Kant. I think
Kant?
Therefore I am. Yeah.
That was Descartes. Yeah.
Was Jefferson an Enlightenment?
Yeah, I guess
character?
He would be.
He would be a
character. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Our founding fathers.
Okay. All right.
Absolutely. And same for Paul Revere. But you see that Paul Revere print of the Boston Massacre, which granted, it was plagiarism too, because somebody had done that very same image before him and he largely copied it and had a better means of distribution. So he got it out there to change people's minds about what the British presence was, and it inflamed people's thinking about that situation.
Now, all of these things have to be connected to me, obviously.
Obviously.
Since you mentioned the volcanoes, Marjorie has forgotten the story, of course. When I was a bit younger, I was in Hawaii, and I not only visited that volcano where the steam vents were, sending up stuff, I ran through the crater of the – I ran up the side of the volcano.
Through
this is totally true.
The crater.
Through the crater with the – whatever it's called, the thing, stuff coming up, not lava, from the steam vents. You're jealous, I can tell. You're trying
Jim
to mock
to
me.
Had to race the lava down the mountainside.
No, I did not. See, everything I say, you have to, ruin to humiliate me.
All I had, I just had a picture of Jim with a spear roasting a marsh.
Okay, can I withdraw? Is that live on radio or what was that? Let's withdraw that.
Okay.
Okay, what are you doing, assuming you continuing with your work on your show, which has been on about a 2-year hiatus? Are you on the air this Friday or what's the deal?
I told you it takes a lot of work to rally the GOP. You understand
it does.
What's been going on last?
It's not easy.
I don't have time to do the show anymore.
By the way, he just lost the fourth ballot for whatever it's worth. Yeah. 20 votes for the guy Donalds from Florida. But go ahead. What are you doing?
I'm on with you right now, and I'm not dealing with the vote. That's why we're in round 4.
Yeah, when does he give up? I don't know.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
We're looking at the I sat down with the creative team behind Life of Pi.
Oh, great.
Oh, excellent.
So you'll get a whole sense of how puppetry comes to life, really. It's all – and they talk about how breath is the means of making the puppet alive but also communicating when you're inside the puppet. So we show you how that show is done while it's here at the ART and before it opens on Broadway in March.
Oh, fabulous. That's great, actually.
Jared, thank you very much.
Thanks. Feel free to show up next time we're talking, okay? Is that okay?
Well, if I can get things fixed on my end, I'll be there.
Okay, good enough. Jared, it's great to
see you.
Thank
you very much,
Jared
Bowen.
See you soon.
Jared Bowen is GBH Executive Arts Editor. He hosts Open Studio with Jared Bowen on GBH2. You can see it every Friday night at 8:30. You can also look at it online. Coming up, naturalist and author Cy Montgomery is here for Afternoon Zoo and to explain why the human-horse connection goes so deep. She's also going to talk about coyotes running amok. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browder, joined now on the phone by Cy Montgomery for 2023's first edition of the Afternoon Zoo on BPR. Cy, of course, is a journalist, naturalist, and author, and a BPR contributor. Her latest book is The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. Hello, Cy Montgomery, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you. I hope it's treating you both well.
Well, for 3 days it has.
Yeah, so far
well,
so good. So, Cy Montgomery,
let's
keep
that up.
We're going to start with a sad story. We have a lot of non-sad stories, but this is a really tough one. Talking about a porpoise, a variety of porpoise I'd never even heard of.
Nor had I.
And its travails in the northern Gulf of California. What's going on?
Oh, gosh, this is so heartbreaking, but there's still hope. This is an animal. It sounds like, you know, Dakin Toys made it up. It is so cute. It's like a cross between a dolphin and a panda. It's a little porpoise with black patches around the eyes. He's a squat little guy. And they live right next door to us, not here in New England, but off Baja, California, Mexico. And there's only 10 of them left.
Yeah, 10 of them.
We know what is killing them. Well, it's so upsetting. And we've known about this for a while, and the animal keeps dwindling and dwindling in number. What's driving its extinction is gill netting for a large fish whose swim bladder is used in Chinese medicine because it's believed to have magical properties that it does not possess.
Yeah, horrible.
So it's such a big mess. And they've known that this animal is endangered. In fact, a very good friend of mine, Brooke Besessen, wrote an entire book about this and has worked very hard to save them. We know exactly what to do. There is a marine sanctuary which is illegal to enter with gill nets. And yet, you know, the Mexican Navy cannot seem to hold off these cartels of fishermen who go in to illegally capture these fish for their swim bladders for a Chinese medicine remedy that doesn't even work.
So
they're going to be gone, basically.
Yeah,
they're going to be gone.
Yeah.
Well, it's bad, but they do run these numbers. Scientists can run these numbers based on the genetics of the animals. And they say that even with only 10 animals left, it is possible to bring them back and that they won't go through a horrible genetic bottleneck in which you're, you know, you're dating your cousin and people turn out with three eyes and whatever. you know, that happens.
It happens. Like, yeah, it happens.
I think we all know about families like that. But they say that, you know, if we could stop gill netting just in this one sanctuary tomorrow, if we could do that tomorrow, the animals would rebound amazingly quickly. And we've done this with animals who are down to just a few creatures. There's the island fox off the Channel Islands of Santa Barbara, who was down to just a handful of animals. There was the California condor, down to a handful of animals. So
I want to add one to your list, because a local guy's involved, Derek Jackson, formerly of the Globe.
Oh, the puffins.
Now, puffins.
Puffins.
The East puffins on, was it Easter Island or whatever it is, where they brilliantly brought them back. Have they not, their son?
Exactly. Side? Exactly. Yes, Steve Kress largely.
That's who it
that
is, Steve Kress, right. Yeah.
Everybody said that couldn't be done. So, you know, we can do these things. We just have to enforce the laws that Mexico itself has enacted. And we have to help them, because we could do stuff in America that we're not doing. We could invoke the Pelley Agreement to compel Mexico to enforce their own laws. We could stop the import of these bladders, which a lot of them actually come through the United States before they go out. They get so much money from these things. They're like cocaine. They're worth more than gold, and yet, you know, they have no curative value at all. Meanwhile, the sick people that are taking them to get better aren't getting better because they aren't getting real medicine. It's crazy. But, you know, it's hard for us to, you know, we're the pot calling the kettle black, because we've got our own right whales, you know, who are down to 350.
Correct.
But guess what? I think today there's going to be, I hope it's signed by the governor today if it hasn't already happened, a proclamation making Right Whale Day be April 24, in which we all think about this beautiful animal that we nearly extinguished. And, you know, as we all realize, awareness is the first step, only the first step.
By the way, you know, speaking of the right, which governor, by the way, Massachusetts or New Hampshire? What are you talking
about? Maine?
No, your governor.
Oh, our governor.
Oh, our governor.
Which is still Charlie Baker, I believe.
Oh,
as of, yeah, he's still the, you know, but, you know, since you mentioned the right whale, we've mentioned this before, and to you, we have David Abel on the show a lot, who's the environmental reporter for the Globe. He did a film about right whales. It's called Entangled, and it's almost the exact same story about the vaquita, is how you say the porpoise, Si?
Yeah, yeah.
About the vaquita porpoise. It's because of the gill nets in the northern Gulf of Mexico, and it's because of the lobster traps, right?
It's the rope.
Yeah, the trap, the rope and the traps.
And
that's what entangled means. It's a variation on the theme.
They could do the ropeless netting. It's more expensive, but there's ways.
The technology exists.
Yes, the technology exists. And, you know, there's a hostility, not among all the fishermen, because they have to earn a living, but among some of the fishermen saying, no, we're not going to concede anything. We're not going to do this, because they just think that they shouldn't have to.
Well, in his film, there was almost a deal that was cut that ultimately fell apart. You know, one of the things, we spoke yesterday to Gina McCarthy, former head of the EPA and a climate advisor to the climate advisor to Joe Biden. And we were talking about the 60 Minutes piece on Friday night with Paul Ehrlich, talking about the extinction of all kinds of animals on the planet right around the corner, and the end of biodiversity. And a story that almost reaches that proportion but had a happier ending were these bats that were frozen, essentially, because of climate change
rapid
issues.
Weather changes.
Yeah, that were brought back to healthy life. I think I got that right. Can you share the story with us,
Si? Yeah. Oh, yeah, this was such a happy kind of Christmassy story.
Yeah.
No, it was like It's a Wonderful Life. This one, and it's one person who did this. This one person saved over 1,600 bats from certain death. And she was the wildlife director at the Houston Humane Society. She's worked with bats since 2019, when there was a freakish cold snap, and started rescuing them. Well, December 21, there was a horrendous cold snap in Houston, in which the temperatures dropped from 60 during the day to the 20s. And these poor bats, they just went hypothermic, and they couldn't even hold on to their roost anymore. And they fell 30 feet from their roost under, well, a lot of times they roost under these big bridges in Houston. smack, these tiny little animals smack on the ground. They look totally dead. She drove by thinking, you know, I better check on them. She picked up 138 of them, rushed them to her house, which is 40 minutes away. She started heating them up by the car seats, you know, the heated car seats. And within 20 minutes, some of them were moving. They were coming back to life. And then later that evening, she went back to the same bridge and she got another 50.
Hold on.
She got a call from someone who'd found 920 more.
Wait a minute. Hold on for a second.
She rushes out.
She's got these bats in her car, warming them up at the car seat. Isn't she concerned they might start flying around inside the car and land in her hair or something like that?
I've had things wake up in my car.
I'm sure you have.
In fact, here in Hancock, we had someone who picked up a bobcat who was
put it
in the cruiser, and then it got well. And he had a live, you know, wiggling bobcat in the front seat.
Oh, my God.
Anyway,
that's happened to me a lot of times, too, actually, Si. It's incredible. So what did he do when the bobcat woke up? I know that's not our topic. What did he do then? Open the door and let it out?
The bobcat started to not feel well again and laid back down. And he was not driving too far, so
that's
he got
good.
Him out of it. And my friends at Turtle Rescue Lead have had snappers break out of the, you know, they were rescued and break out of their bins and start crawling into the front seat. People have dealt with these kind of things before. But anyway, the bats just started to move. They didn't actually start to fly. And they don't get in your hair, Marjorie. I want to assure you. I actually put a bunch of bats in my hair once
to
see what they would do. And they were horrified. They couldn't wait to get out of my hair.
Si, I hope you don't take this the wrong way. But we're talking to Si Montgomery, one of our favorite people.
That's right.
Why would you put bats in your head, Si? What was the goal of that experiment?
Well, I was with my friend Tom Kuntz, who, alas, is deceased now. He used to be doing a big study of bats up here in New Hampshire, and I was helping him move these bats. We were tagging them to see where they went, and so you first had to capture them, and we were capturing them in these things called a tuttle trap, and you could just reach into the tuttle trap, and these uninjured bats, you could get handfuls of them, and then so naturally I thought, what would happen if I put some in my hair? So what happened was the bats were like, I want to get out of here. Bats, the last thing is going to fly into your hair because they have echolocation. They actually can with their echolocation detect a single human hair and fly around it. Yes, they are really good at it, but they have to know to turn on their echolocation, which they usually have on.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so this lady, her name is Mary Warwick, and she's a saint. She now has picked up the 920 additional bats, and she has 1,602 bats at her house.
Mm.
So she calls her backup from Bat World Sanctuary in Northern Texas.
Yep.
But they couldn't accommodate the bats.
Nope.
But they helped her come up with a recovery plan, and she warmed some of them in incubators. Others that were feeling better, she moved into dog kennels and put in the attic. She administered fluids. She looked to see, you know, who may have broken their arm, an injury sustained in the fall. The reason that she put them in the attic, it was cool but not freezing up there. And you didn't want them to want to eat because then you've got to force feed 1,000 bats who normally would hunt insects on the wing. And to get them to eat, you would pretty much have to force feed all of them.
Individual bats.
Yes. And they're great little animals. I love bats. They're the most adorable things. They're the closest things we actually have to angels because they are flying mammals. And they're sweet little things. They're smart.
They're
affectionate. They're wonderful. Most of these guys were Mexican free-tailed bats, but I think there's like 8 species of bats in her area. So she released almost all of them. They're almost all back now with their colonies, and they rented this this lift thing. It's called like a scissor lift, so that they drive underneath the bridge. The bridge was like 30 feet high, and lifted them up so that they could hear the voices of their friends. They recognized the individual voices of their friends
that
they always roost next to, and they rose up and joined them, and now they're back helping us deal with insects and eating all kinds of moths that threaten our crops, and it's just such a happy story, and I think she's a saint.
Beautifully told by you too, Cy Montgomery, as always. We are talking to Cy Montgomery.
So, Cy Montgomery, I absolutely love the story about the human-horse connection, the human being with the predator brain and the horse with the prey brain, and how, as this story put it, the people, there's a mutual cross-species interaction between the human and the horse. Tell us.
Yeah. Well, first, did you ride, I wonder?
I did ride, and that's why I was so into this, because especially if you go over jumps with a horse.
You did jumping
yeah,
with a horse?
Yeah, when Smith College is famous for having
I know they have horses there, I know.
How you're almost like one thing going over the jump.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So this must have really resonated
with you. It
did. I used to ride, too. And I love the story. It was on Aon, which is this online magazine. It's fantastic. It was by brain researcher Janet Jones. And she was writing about what she calls this intricate neural dance between good riders and their mounts. And it answers the question that, as a little girl, I always wondered, you know, why does this 1,200-pound animal let me ride around on it?
Right.
Why don't they just revolt? You know, how do we convince them to jump over some obstacle that's 8 feet tall? Or you know, how do we persuade them to move their legs to music and that freestyle dressage? And it's not just that we're passengers steering these horses to do something. It's way more than that. And we can credit, says this brain researcher, the horse's many touch receptors,
yeah,
with innate talent for body language, and the horse's ability to learn much more quickly than we thought, and our own ability to sense what the horses are saying to us through our nervous systems that are almost connected during these moments.
Yeah.
They essentially, we meld our nervous systems together because, you know, there you use just a little movement of your inner calf or your inner thigh. And this 1,200-pound animal moves instantly to the side that you ask for.
That's incredible.
And, you know, the rider, you know, you can instantly sense when the horse has changed path. And then you get the body ready for the next activity. And you can do that with just a slight change of weight. And it really is amazing, particularly since you consider that we are predators and they are prey.
Right.
And in fact, people ate the earliest horses like mad. That's what they were for as far as humans were concerned. We didn't start riding them. We ate them.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you also think about how horses can sense when a rider is in control and when a rider is out of control, and also when you think of horses in war zones, you know, that these unbelievable stories about horses going into battle, especially like in the Civil War in the United States, and where, I mean, their ability to just march ahead.
Yes, because they trust you. And because you listen to them, you teach them,
yeah,
that they can trust you. And they teach you that you can trust them. And since we are a predator and they are prey, together we have the superpowers of everybody. We can rely on each other's strengths because, you know, horses are so vigilant. They'll notice everything,
yep,
right?
Like little noises,
we're better at
scare
focus,
them. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
And if, you know, some rustling thing in the grass,
yep,
is freaking them out right as they need to jump over and, you know, a big jump, we can help them focus their attention and say, don't pay attention to that, trust me. Whereas we can trust them to tell us if, you know, some errant animal is running into our path just when we're charging forward. So, you know, we gain superpowers. You can calm a nervous horse with your body language, and they can alert you to stuff that you should be nervous about. And so there's this great feedback loop. You trust them, they seek your guidance, they trust you, and you learn to listen.
By the way, I hope people notice that Cy Montgomery very wisely only asked Marjorie if she rode and not me. And believe me, that was the right choice, Cy Montgomery. So, Cy, before you go, speaking of horses, as Marty said, can sense when you're in control. Apparently coyotes. Didn't Alex Beam tell us that you pronounce it coyotes?
Coyotes.
How do you pronounce coyote?
Oh, gosh. I could say coyote.
Okay, fine, coyote.
Coyote.
So I'm sure you read the story. We're,
yes,
going to talk to listeners about it in a minute. Nahant, which is essentially this little island, virtually, right by Lynn there, has a problem with, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of a dozen coyotes, and they're attacking dogs, and they're
children.
Was there children in Nahana, or was that in another community? Whatever it was.
No, they haven't attacked children yet.
But they've attacked children.
They've
attacked children elsewhere, but not fatally kind of thing. I'm sure you know that what the whatever the governing body is has sought assistance from, I think it's federal authorities, to shoot these things.
Yeah.
Knowing you as we do, I'm assuming you feel that's an inappropriate response. And if I'm right, what is the solution for people who have legit fears for themselves, their kid, or their pet about these coyotes essentially coming to a neighborhood near us?
Yeah. Well, essentially, the sharpshooter method, unless you have one Osama bin Laden-type coyote, which was the case in that other town, there was one coyote who people were feeding who made three attacks on a child. They knew who the coyote was. They killed him, and he was gone. Okay, so that works. But all the studies that have been done, including by my trusted friend Chris Shadler, says that just randomly shooting, poisoning, trapping coyotes just causes them to breed earlier and have larger litters. It does not do anything to change the numbers, and it doesn't make them easier to live with. What folks need to do is, as a community, and I hope it's not too late at this point, but as a community, you have to establish boundaries for the coyotes by not running away from them. Instead, make a big racket, hose them with water, chase them away. And I totally can understand how upsetting it is. The stories about what has happened to some of these little dogs is really awful.
Yeah.
One lady walking her chihuahua.
I know.
She was actually on her front porch.
I know. That one was really horrible.
But now people are dressing their dogs in these coyote suits.
With spikes
online.
Spikes on this.
They don't look like a coyote. They look like they're covered with spikes or like bird spikes. There's many different designs, and they're actually reviewed on this website. And I actually can offer some advice if you're looking for what the smartly dressed Nahant dog should be wearing. You need a Kevlar coat, you need good belly coverage, and you need coverage of your neck. I mean, it seems crazy that you have to dress up your dog in this way, but until they get this under control, your dog isn't even safe on your leash. And the reason we have this problem, we didn't even have coyotes in New England. As you know, they did not exist here. They were some Western animal nobody out here had ever seen. But we killed off all our wolves, and then coyotes started moving east, and they bred with wolves, and now you have this super coyote, which has the most flexible and adaptive characteristics of both wolves and Western coyotes. They're like a super dog.
And the coyotes were having a hell of a time doing it, too, let me tell you, Si.
Yeah. No, it's true. Exactly. Did you see the video of someone's porch? They had like a surveillance video set up on their porch.
With the little kid, the coyote off the driveway.
Yeah.
Going after the little kid.
Yeah, the dad had to run out.
And
the
father, talk about great, good for, obviously you would do that, but good for them. Hey, Si Montgomery, you're fabulous. We love talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Si.
Oh, you're fabulous. I love you both, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. We have been speaking with Si Montgomery, journalist, naturalist, author, BPR contributor, and uplifting guest in the nth degree.
She is.
Her latest
really
book is The Hawk's Way, Encounters with Fierce Beauty. Thanks again to Si Montgomery. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about coyotes. Nahant is a coyote problem. The coyotes have a Nahant problem. We'll open the lines to hear from you about the growing tensions between humans and coyotes, not to mention coyotes and small dogs in or sometimes even big dogs in Massachusetts. The number is 877-301-8970. You can call or text us with your coyote stories. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Kevin McCarthy was defeated on the fourth ballot. They're on to the fifth. We just talked about the coyotes in the hunt with Cy Montgomery, and we want to open the lines to you. The things that should be interesting in this discussion are twofold, I think, Marjorie. One, people's personal experiences with coyotes, and two, if you can work George Santos into the discussion. And I think you can. Dozens of pets in the community have gone missing. A few leashed dogs have died in attacks.
No, it's terrible.
And it's a deviation from normal coyote behavior, but they're obviously getting closer to all of us. As we mentioned, the problem has gotten so dire that Nahant, is that a town? What is Nahant?
I don't know.
Town, has called in the big guns, literally federal sharpshooters, to cull the coyote population in hopes of targeting the more aggressive animals. Last year, I think it was Arlington weather. It was Arlington, yeah, weathered three coyote on human attacks. Two of them kids, prompting the town to hold safety seminars and set up some neighborhood watch group on Facebook to alert neighbors of coyote sightings. So a couple of things. One, please share your personal, up close and personal, as I said, encounters with coyotes or coyotes, whatever you want to say. And we'd also like your perspective on the whole Nahant issue. Is it just a matter of learning to coexist with our animal neighbors, much like the massive and seemingly fearless turkeys of Brookline and Cambridge, whose beaks are at crotch level for most men? Or are you on the side of Nahant, the first community in Massachusetts to ask the feds for help to cull the herd? 877-301-8970. We're short on time, so we'll try to get to a lot of calls. But before we do, where are you on the Nahant shoot the coyotes?
I don't think you should shoot the coyotes.
What should you do?
Well, you got to be really
careful.
Didn't they
capture a dog on the Cape near your house there?
They captured a friend of mine's dog.
They killed the damn dog?
They killed the dog. The dog was out. She let the dog out in the backyard at night, and the coyote came in and killed the dog, and there was just this little ball of fur left. It was terrible.
No, is that true?
And my neighborhood all the time, I see there are coyotes in my neighborhood, too.
Wait, in Brookline?
Yeah, 2 miles from Fenway Park. Yeah.
In Brookline?
Yes, there are tons of them. And you see signs all the time, cat missing, cat missing, cat missing.
Oh, that is horrible.
Cat is missing. And you could hear them sometimes at night screeching when they're killing something. It's really horrible screeching. I hear them all the time down the Cape. But on the other hand, and there's terrible things have happened. Swamp's got this story in the Globe reports. 9 coyotes at least surrounded this guy while he was walking his dog, and he had to call the cops, and the cops came, and the cops had to get the coyotes out of there. There was a gentleman in Roslindale, which of course is part of Boston, who had three large coyotes following him and his dog during the day near Delano Park there, and around the corner from Poplar Street, which is a very populated areas, obviously. So I mean, there are more and more of them. We're encroaching on their land.
Well, you know, one interesting aside before we get to that, you probably know this because you've been doing a lot of reading on it. While he was working at Goldman Sachs, George Santos raised thousands of coyotes in his apartment. Did you know that?
I thought
in his actual apartment.
He was a sharpshooter. He'd taken out about 2 dozen of them right there.
He actually did it on the way to Capitol Hill this morning.
Exactly. They're live in Washington, D.C.
Jay,
but they are scary. They are very scary.
They are very, but they're small-ish, but
well,
they're very scary.
Sometimes they're pretty big. Sometimes,
well, if you're small, they're big.
I had a
if
friend
you're big,
whose, whose
small.
Dog who had a big dog, a big Labrador. Well, she heard the commotion.
What happened?
She went out. She went out with a shovel. And started attacking the coyote with the shovel. Coyote took off.
Story.
He's supposed to scream and yell and make a lot of noise, but sometimes they ignore that.
They do.
But her dog, a big dog, like an 80-pound
lab.
What
happened to the dog?
The dog survived because she went out and rescued the dog. But what they do, and this is very scary.
It's the longest story. Like
well,
in
let me
weeks
just say,
here,
there'll be one coyote, and then they get their gang. So there's one coyote you may be able to ward off or fight off.
But
the
they call
coyote.
For the other ones, like in a Disney movie kind
five
of thing,
or
with
six
like hyenas.
Or, coyotes, and suddenly you're in big trouble.
We have George Santos had hyenas, actually, in his other bedroom. He raised wild hyenas, and he tamed them. Do you know that? He domesticated hyenas. In his apartment.
He played Mustafa
Trump
in The Lion King, you know, as well. He starred. It
Jay
was a great
in Somerville,
role.
You are first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the coyote explosion, what to do about it. Hey there.
Hey, how are you all? Love you both.
Thank you.
So we had a Maine Coon cat, and the Maine Coon ended up living out on the Cape with my parents, and this Maine Coon would, I mean, it got everything. The birds, the bunnies. It had like a shrine of heads somewhere. I mean, it was like a ridiculous cat. And of course, as the cat got a little older, a little slower, and then we realized at one point, my dad, early in the morning, the coyote got the Maine Coon. But we realized it was like, if it was going to go circle of life, it was kind of the right way. It felt like, you know, die by the sword and... you know, it was all, we sort of were able to deal with that just because the cat itself had done its damage. And then afterwards, all the bunnies and birds came back.
Cats do a number
on
the birds.
That was a great story,
right?
Jay.
Yeah,
that's a great one. Thanks.
I think that the cats are the biggest reasons for bird deaths.
I had a coon cat, by the way, years ago. It was like 19 pounds.
Yeah, they're big.
It was huge.
Very big.
Really huge.
Let us go to, that was Jay.
We'll go somewhere in a second.
We're going to Rama in the car.
Hey
Hi,
there.
Rama.
How are you?
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
So I've had a number of encounters with coyotes, and you know they don't want anything to do with me. I've walked right. They've walked right in front of me in Magnolia. But bottom line is what Cy said. Did you hear her? If we call the herd, kill any of them, they will. And I've heard this many, many times from Massachusetts Division of Wildlife and other places. It's common knowledge. If we try to kill them, they will breed more prolifically. They're that adaptable. So
I didn't know that.
It's going to backfire. Well, Cy said that, Jim.
No, I knew. I didn't know it prior to Cy having said it, and now obviously you're confirming
it. Common knowledge for people who are in the, who are biological, who study this kind of thing. So it's nothing new. The federal wildlife people will know this too. They're not going to come in and shoot the coyotes because they'll proliferate more. So.
Yeah,
that seems to be.
We got to live with each other.
I guess we do.
Yeah,
Thank you.
We're getting text messages about that too. The
coexistence thing?
No, that if you shoot them and then they just proliferate.
They reproduce
fast.
Reproduce
really
By the
quickly.
Way, speaking of Cy Montgomery, I gave a neighbor a soul of an octopus for Christmas, and she texted me last night saying how much she loved it. One of the great books ever. It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful book.
Talk about interspecies relationships, which I sort of love.
Yeah, the Hawk book is great. Soul of the Octopus
is great.
I just
said Soul of the Octopus. Were you paying attention?
I was looking at the
Where are you?
I was looking at the text
but
messages.
But I was talking. What happened?
You tell me to look at the text messages.
Well, why, but
I'm
I
looking
was
at the text
it.
Messages. Well, I can't do everything at once.
Well, can you look at me now?
Hi, Jim.
Thank you. How are you? Let's go to Al. Let's go to Al on the road. We're talking about coyotes as Kevin McCarthy is trying to become the Speaker of the House for the fifth time. Al on the road. What's up, Al?
Since you brought that up, hunting coyotes is about as difficult as Kevin McCarthy's having a time trying to become Speaker of the House.
Oh, yeah?
I think that's true.
Yeah.
How
they're,
so?
They're very smart.
Yeah.
And they're very, very, they're very difficult to, you can't trap them. They figure out traps right away.
Really?
Need callers. Yeah. It's best to hunt them at night. There is a coyote season in Massachusetts till March, but it's so difficult to hunt them that it doesn't really do anything to the population.
Do you have personal? You sounds like you have personal encounters, kind of thing. Do you?
I've shot one coyote
while
I was goose hunting, actually, because it came in and attacked my goose decoys. But I deer hunt as well. I see them a lot when I'm deer hunting, and they've gotten to the deer before I have. After I've successfully harvested a deer, and
wow.
they'll eat a deer alive.
Oh.
They'll absolutely grab your cat and run away with it.
Mm.
The problem is we've made it too easy for them to survive, and we give them abundant food sources. So what we need to do is make it more difficult for them, and then they don't have it because they will reproduce as much as they can. To as long as the area that they're in can sustain.
Yeah, he's
population.
Saying the same thing. They blank like bunnies, apparently.
So Al, since you are an experienced hunter, what do you think people should do? Just go out with a baseball bat when they're walking their small dog, or what?
Keep your cats inside. You shouldn't have outdoor cats are horrible. Yeah.
Outdoor cats do a lot of damage. You're right. They do.
Al, thank
you.
Sorry, what? Go ahead.
Outdoor cats are a favorite target of coyotes.
Yeah, but little dogs are too, right? There's a little chihuahua, 12-pound chihuahua, was taken right off the porch. Penelope, that was
her name.
Is that
the name of the dog?
Yeah. Yes.
I have a small pug, and he doesn't go outside by himself. We live in a wooded area.
Huh.
But we have to make it more difficult for them to survive. If hunting's part of that equation, then so be it.
So be it. There you go. Al, thank you. Now, Marjorie, I'm in the studio with Marjorie, so I can look at her face. She's sort of downtrodden because of this discussion. I'm going to lift her spirits.
Okay.
Here is a reporter confronting George Santos. Excuse me. Congressman-elect George Santos, just as he's about to walk into the Capitol, and he is looking at his phone as he's being questioned by this young reporter. Here it is.
What's your name today? Is it Anthony DeVolder or is it George Santos?
Do you think anyone in New York actually trusts you? Do you have any idea what you're doing today? Are you pretending to look at your phone?
That's my favorite part. This is a long pause.
Are you pretending?
He's walking with Santos, and he says, "You pretending to look at his phone," which obviously is doing. Marjorie's now smiling.
So Lauren Boebert nominated Byron Donald
a second time.
Second time.
He's the congressman from Florida.
He
may be the only African American Republican in the House. There may be two, but I'm not sure.
I don't know.
And he was the. For, if people don't know, there were 19 votes for someone other than McCarthy yesterday in the first two ballots. He was interviewed on CNN saying Donald. So he was open to voting for somebody else. He became the 20th vote, and today on the fourth and apparently fifth ballot, he's the nominee for those who are unhappy with McCarthy as. Leader. Let's go to Noreen in a car. We're talking about coyotes taking over Massachusetts, or at least part of it. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey.
I grew up in Lynn, the youngest of four, and when I went off to college, my parents decided to downsize from the big house to a little cape in Nahant. So this was 1978. My oldest brother went with them to live there, and about a decade ago, my brother bought that house and continues to live in that house, and yet he is still not considered a Nahant native. And so my thinking is the Nahanters will not welcome these coyotes, even though many of them may have been born in Nahant and are Nahant natives, because that's just their M.O.
Well, I have to say, it's not just Nahant and your sibling there. Bostonians, when are you considered a Bostonian? Remember during the mayoral campaign? Because Michelle Wu had moved from Chicago.
Oh, yeah, she people really made a count. Big deal about
well,
that.
I moved
yeah.
to Cambridge, right. And it took decades.
Good kind point,
of. By the way, how is your – it's your brother, you said, right? Is that what you said, Noreen?
Correct.
How's yeah. he dealing – how's he feeling about the coyote issue?
I don't – he lives right on the – right by the causeway at the edge of Nahant. I don't think he sees too many of them.
Really? Yeah, it's
but I will tell you this with regard to Bostonians and the territorialism. I grew up in Lynn. I lived in Nahant for a number of years. I've been a Salemite since 1986, and I am embraced in this town. I've served office in this town. I'm considered a Salemite.
Very good.
My Lynn roots.
Well, I want you to know that you're speaking to two people who love Salem, and we always say, we mention Salem, the Peabody Essex Museum is one of the great museums on the planet. Right there in downtown Salem. Noreen, it's good to talk to you. Thank you so much for the call. You have any final thoughts, Margaret?
Well, a texter says that this story reminds me of the time George Santos saved me from a pack of wild coyotes while we were in the SEAL Team
I
6
saw that.
Together.
I saw that video of him doing it.
Yeah,
his bravery.
He's unbelievable.
He doesn't even talk about that much, which is really humble and beautiful.
And our listeners, you know, with dogs, they talk about, going out with those air horns to make a big noise yeah. or going out. Paul from Wizard talks about.
Vuvuzelas or whatever they're
yeah,
called.
Yeah, going out with a baseball bat when he walks his dog at night. So you have to be really careful of the coyotes, Jim. That was the word
well, I'm
to
glad
the
we resolved that
if
problem.
If you've got a couple of dogs in your family, you better be careful.
I do.
Better get your baseball bat and your air horn and your spiked little metal jacket.
I've got them already.
You can wear the spiked
metal
jacket.
I'm wearing the exactly.
Okay. We're done. Thank
Breaking
you very
news,
much.
George Santos has been selected to hunt the coyotes in Nahant. I mean, this guy is everywhere. It's so beautiful.
Okay.
Give him a chance.
You can keep up with us 24/7 if you haven't had enough of us by way of our podcast, maybe which is
have.
Called Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined by NBC's Chuck Todd. I can't wait to talk to him
Nor
about what's going on
I.
in Congress. I mean, it's so humiliating. Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral, Rebecca Gerwitz from the Massachusetts Association of Social Workers and the state's new Behavioral Health Helpline.
That is really an exciting project.
Deal.
Yeah.
And the Boston Globe's Shirley Young and one more NPR TV critic, Eric Deggans, on everything that's hot to watch and stream now on TV. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas. Additional support provided by Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker with Bill Piacentelli on the board. Don't we have somebody else on the board?
I don't know if we're supposed to say it. We'll
okay,
say
then we won't say
tomorrow
it.
First. I don't
okay.
know if we're supposed to.
Our executive producer is Jane Bologna, John the Claw
can we say?
Parker.
We can say. A former
okay.
colleague of ours
yes.
from our old life.
From our old life.
Brian Bell
is
Whoa.
Here on the boards as
we're
well.
Thrilled
with
to have
Bill
you, Brian.
Piacentelli, while John the Claw Parker is not here. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Brown. You know what Brian has in common with us? We all got screwed by our former company. No, I'm only kidding. I'm Jim Browdy. I think she said that. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope that.